We've started. With that in mind, let's talk about this class just for everybody here. So this is professional practice. We are going to talk about today, we're going to talk about the class as a structure, how it's going to be broken up over the semester, and what you guys need to know, and hopefully a little perk for everybody that makes you guys want to be incentivized to come with us. By the way, has anybody here, do you guys know anything about my class? Has anybody talked to the other students? You have. Who did you talk to from last year? Okay. Did I get good, like, did he say anything? Cool. All right. If I didn't, just thank you for lying. Sorry. So, I'm glad that at least one person knows about the class. So, as I talked to you guys before, this is about teaching you guys about some realities in law and business and construction and architecture. And I'm going to talk about the construction industry includes architecture, but you guys are going to be interacting with contractors all the time. You're going to be interacting with owners. So we look at that, and what you're going to learn over the semester is a triangle. Top of the triangle is the owner, and the two points at the bottom are the architect and the contractor. I'm going to be talking about this triangle all the time. One thing just get in your mind is the triangle has only two solid lines. Owner to contractor, owner architect. The bottom's a dashed line. The lines for visual imagery means a contract. The parties had legal obligations to each other. The dotted line means they communicate, but they don't owe anything to each other. They have no contract with each other. That's the basic parameters of construction. Now, there's a whole bunch of different ways you can put that together. We'll get to that in the second half of the semester. But that's just what we're going to talk about as the construction industry. So I'm here to kind of teach you about the construction industry. Let's go to the next slide. And let's talk about how the class works. So talk a little bit about it. The first half, we're going to talk more theory of the law. This is going to be the more boring part. What is a tort? Anybody heard the word tort? Oh, so a couple. What's a tort? What do you know?
It's a legal way to bring claims that have damages, financial or injury.
Injury. That's the most important part. Someone's injured. If you can bring a claim for damages for a breach of contract, and you can bring a claim for damages for a tort. And torts can be like bodily injury, or it could be somebody trespassing, or it could be destruction of property. Somebody crashes into your car, there's a tort. So there's two different lines. So we're going to talk about theory, boring things like torts and contracts. Did you have a question? Okay. So, second half, and we'll bleed a little bit that into the first half as well, is some practical applications, like what happens in the real world. I, as you guys have seen, am a storyteller. I will tell stories about real cases. The names will be changed to protect my clients and to protect my professionalism because I have ethical obligations that I can't relate to those, put them out. But those will be talked about so you can hear real-world applications. So when I talk about a tort, I can say, oh, I was in this case where this guy fell through an elevator shaft, and then I'll tell you a story about this and that so you will understand it. So hopefully it has, like I said, a more visual and real impact of what the class or what the issue is about. But it's going to be more theory in the first half, and then we'll take a midterm. And then the second half is more practical application. How does an office work? How do you build a building? Like, as far as the economics of it. I have a project, or I have a lecture called The Economics of Construction. And it goes through a scenario on the, like, at 30,000 feet of if you were a developer and you're building a building, and how much it would cost, and how do you do that? Because sometimes your clients are going to ask you, can you help me with a budget? I've never done this before. I want to build a house. Can you help me with a budget for that? They're going to look to you guys for that. And you'll be like, I didn't learn any of that stuff. Well, hopefully I can tell you a little bit about it so you can learn and have some basis for that. I will get out of syllabus, and then I'll have my contact information. That'll come out. Like I said, I will get it. I'm going to try to get it done this weekend. It's been a little bit crazy the beginning of the year. We're going to go through the syllabus. We'll have my contact information and lecture topics. It's going to say what we're going to talk about every single week. And it's going to talk about key documents for the class. There is no textbook. You don't have to go out and buy anything. There are only two documents that you guys should get. One is the AIA B101. It is a contract. Now, if you go to the AIA website, you can't get it from them because they have this really aggressive copyright protection and everything else. But if you just Google the AIA B101 sample thing, you'll pop it up and you can see it. I will go through the provisions of that. The reason why it's good for you to have that is because those are a couple of lectures that I go that are rapid fire because they're really long contracts with teeny tiny little 8-point font. And so if you guys have had a chance to take a look at it, you can actually take your notes on it or however you want to do it, or you can do it electronically. That's the first one. The second one is the AIA A201. The B101 is an owner-architect agreement, that first part of the triangle that's solid. The A201 is the owner-contractor agreement. And that's the other part of it. And we'll go through that because the AIA series contracts, and they have A series, B series, C series, and they skip D, I don't know why, and E and F. Those contracts are used in about 80%, 75% of all of the projects you guys will work on the rest of your career. Now, it might not say AIA on it because sometimes an architecture firm is going to take that contract and they're like, I don't like all these provisions, I want to make it specialized for me, and I'm tired of paying the royalty fees to the AIA, so they create their own by like cribbing a whole bunch of stuff from the AIA contract. So I see lots of contracts, I'm like, oh, this is an AIA contract, mostly, but it doesn't say it on it. So you guys will, and that's what you'll use. So I'm going to talk about those and go through those in detail. Those will be four lectures, two on the B101 and two on the A201. Those will be rushed and fast and a lot of chatting and talking. I highlight stuff that will be important for the exam. Those are the ones, if you ever need to go back and listen to, those are probably the most important ones because there will be an emphasis of those on the exam. And when you go out and you take your ARE, those are the two documents that are the most important documents on the ARE for the legal part. I don't know how much you guys know about the ARE, but there's a bunch of different sessions, a bunch of different days. And there's a day that's all about my class, or a portion of the day that's about my class and stuff like that. Not my class, but what I try to lecture on. Because I want to help you guys be ready for the rest of the world. So that's what those are, the key documents. Lectures and reading. Like I said, the AA documents are important. Lectures showing up, that's about it. That's what you need to do. That's important. Is like I said, you're going to get better grade if you show up. It just happens. You can always write it up. I mean, people can get a C and get up to a B, but if you showed up, you might have gotten a B and you can write up to an A. So, great. Midterm and final, I talked about this. They are multiple choice, open book, open notes. You can do whatever you want. What I have found, and the one thing I've lectured in this room twice, they move me around every year. The problem, the disappointment in this room is you guys don't have the chairs with the arms because most of you guys will eventually probably just come in with your computers. You guys can use them, but it depends on how you want to take your notes and everything else. But a lot of people would come in, they have the slide, they pull it up and they do notes on it. You guys can do however you want to do it, but if you use your computer, like you're using back there, you can bring that into the exam. I don't care. You can bring all your notes back into the exam. It's faster to search. However you guys want to do that, you can do that. But that's what the exams are going to be. There is no homework. Other than if you want to look at my handout when it comes, or if you want to re-listen to the lecture. But I don't assign anybody homework. Okay? Like I said, no books, the two forms. I talked about the opportunity to raise a grade, but that was before we went on tape, so I will repeat it again. You can raise your grade. Now, this says C. So you can go from a B to an A, you can go from C. I just put up a here for a C by writing the papers. The papers, as I said, is a three-page double-spaced paper. It's going to be on a topic we talked about, torts, contracts, slip and fall, the professional practice, whatever it might be. All you do is you send me an email and say, hey, Mike, I'd like to write up my grade. I say, okay, what do you want your topic on? You send me a topic. And I'll say, your topic needs to be on something we lectured in the first part of the semester. Like, I don't want you to make something up. It's hard to make something up. And you'll send me one. 80% of the time you're going to send me one, I'm going to write back and be like, let's narrow it because you guys are up here and I'm going to give you down here. Because if you're writing up here, it's going to take 20 pages. And if I get you down to here, then you can do it in three and it doesn't take too much time. I will help you with that. We'll get a topic. You write the paper. You send it to me. I read it. As long as you don't really like misspell every word and everything else, you get a grade book. Okay? Now, here's the other thing. Every single year, this is without fail. Hopefully it doesn't happen this year. But I emphasize that every single year, there are people that are going to get a C on an exam. They write me, they say they're going to write a paper, we get the paper topic, and then they never turn it in. And I'm like, you got to like spend 3 hours. It doesn't take long to write three pages double spaced, especially in this world. Please don't do ChatGPT world, but I mean, I know good things happen and stuff like that, but just do it so your grade doesn't hurt. I've had too many years where students like end up getting a C in this class. I'm like, you didn't have to. It was so easy. So, if you get a C, send me an email. Write it up. We'll take care of it. That's what I want to do, because I want you to learn. Like I said, critical for attendance is critical for understanding. You do better if you're here than if you're not. But if you're not, we have the things on lecture. They'll be posted on the website. And the last thing, the merit award. The person in this class who has the highest raw score, Because like when you get an exam, when you get your exam, I'm going to raw score it out of, I think the first exam is like 40, 41 questions, somewhere in the mid, early, low 40s questions. The raw score on that. If you have to write it up, your raw score may be going up. It's the raw score, not the score with your write-up from your paper. Person with the best raw score combined of the midterm and final, $1,000 comes from me. Well, it comes to foundation, but I give the money to foundation. But that's it. Well, you get $1,000. And it's one of the awards at the end of the year. So that's for you guys. So that's kind of an incentive. I don't know how it ever works in the class if people like there was one year. I do remember this one year, like years ago, probably like 8 or 10 years ago, there was a student that everybody knew he was going to get it. Like as soon as I talked about it, like, oh, it's going to go to Tom. I don't remember, not you, Tom, but another Tom. Not that you weren't going to get it. But they were like, oh, it's going to go to Tom, whoever it was. I don't remember his name. And they were like, hey, he's going to get it. And he like was way above everybody else. He apparently was super smart. So, but other than that, like, how have you guys, you know, like, I don't know how you guys talk about it with each other. I never, when the scores are put out for your exams, I just put them out by your UIC ID number. I don't tell anybody with that. So, did you have a question?
They split it?
Oh, really? Well, that's cool. That's really cool. One year, and it's only happened one year. One year I gave it out too, and I gave out $2,000. So I hope nobody ever, never, like, it's never a year where it's like 3 or 4 people tied. But in any event, it's part of my give back. So that's really cool that he split it. That's really awesome. He was great. I remember him. Yeah. So anyway, and like I said, you'll find the people that participate are the ones that normally do better because they ask questions and they kind of engage. You're always going to be engaged if you're talking back and forth. So, all right, any questions on this? Cool. Objective of the course. I talked a little bit about this. I want you guys to understand jargon. Like we talked about what a tort is. I want to hear about what a tort is. When I talk about a mechanic's lien, I want you to understand those things. So there's going to be legal jargon. I want to make it human for you. Lawyers speak a different language, French, Latin, all this other stuff, all different languages. So are lawyers' language, and we're really boring sometimes. So I want you guys to learn the language and then make it human for you. So that's really important. One of the things we're going to talk about are types of practices. Like when you're out there, what's the business structure? Is it a partnership? Is it a corporation? Is it an LLC? What are the pros and cons? That's kind of the business reality part of this class. You guys can understand a little bit about that. I want you to understand dispute resolution. Hopefully no one in this room ever gets sued, but if you do, you're in a dispute. Someone's made a claim against you. Your building fell down because you designed it incorrectly. It's because they built it incorrectly, or whatever might be that. That's a dispute. How do we resolve that? There's different types. There's the court, there's mediation, arbitration. We're actually going to talk about that very subject today at the end. I want you to understand business agreements and contracts, how they people talk and communicate, how you guys, what's the deal? When you get together, when an owner hires you, what is the deal? What do you owe them, and what do they owe you? Okay? How to practice architecture is regulated by state and others. Like, you guys have to follow certain requirements that I don't. But as a lawyer, I have to follow certain requirements you don't. There are all these different types of, not a lot, but there are different organizations and agencies that mandate your practice. Because you guys are held to a higher standard. You are not the average Jane and Joe. You are people that are practicing a profession, an amazing profession, but you're still treated as a professional. So how's that handled? Learning and understanding architects' professional practice responsibilities. What do you guys owe as an architect to your client? What do you owe to the public at large? Those types of things. You know, it's not just I'm going to build this cool-looking building. It has to stand up. It has to be able to have electrical and mechanical and fire protection. All these other things that you owe to the people that are coming in and out of the building. And it may be just a family, or maybe in a giant school building. So what are those responsibilities and understanding that? Understanding the economics of architecture and real estate development. Those are very, like I said, I'm meeting 30,000 feet may be too low, maybe 50,000. They're very high level because this isn't a real estate development class. If you want to do that, there's other classes you can take that are going to get more detailed. But I'm going to have two lectures on the economics of construction and developing and running a business, your own business, and they're going to talk a little bit about that. So you just get a flavor of that, but hopefully kind of an understanding. And I think it's good for you to do that. And then just generally recognize the architect's place in the business world. Like, where do you guys fit in? I think it's important. I think a lot of people overshadow the importance of architects. I think one of the worst tragedies, although it's better than it used to be, one of the worst tragedies is how underpaid architects are for what they're giving back to the community and society, what they're doing. Engineers, I don't know if it's the same, but when I got out of school, engineers made at least 30 to 40% more than the architects coming out of school. It was always like, and I'm like, I had to learn engineer, I had to take structures, I had to take all these classes, I have to know how the building stands up, I had to take mechanical engineering, civil engineering, like I had to take all that stuff. And you're getting more money than me, and you just like know one little thing. But that's the reality. And so there is an importance. And so one of the things that I always loved about architecture is that, and it doesn't help with the pocketbook, but there's a fulfilling nature of the architecture for me, at least, that what I'm doing, you give into society. So we'll talk a little bit about that and kind of sprinkle that throughout the lectures. Okay, now we get to talk about some stuff about, like, now the real class is going to start. So we're going to talk about real academic stuff. Oh, one other thing, too. So this class, I try to get, so we go from, we're scheduled from, like, what is it, 9 to 11:45, I think is what our time frame is. I try to get this class done, like, today, hopefully we'll be out by 11:10. I don't like to go the whole time. If I don't have to. The four classes that I will go the whole time are the two on the B101 and the two A201. The other ones, I try to get you guys out earlier because I'm covering what I need to cover. I've done this for many years. I know how to do it. And like 3 hours sitting in the lecture is a long time. So I'll try to get breaks. If anybody needs a break, well, hey, can we take a break? That's totally fine, just to get out of your chair. I get to stand and walk around, which is much easier for me. But that's, I'm going to try to keep it 2:15, somewhere around there. So, okay. So let's talk about laws and levels of government. Okay, so the law, like I said, we're talking way up here, very basic theory over here. So you guys have the laws of nature. You're like, oh my God, why are you talking about the laws of nature? Interestingly enough, you guys have to deal with the laws of nature every day when you guys design wind loads, gravity. All those types of things come in. Those are the laws of nature. And you as an architect have to contemplate the laws of nature. The laws of nature, though, have been around since the beginning of time. Literally, beginning of time. And those are things that govern the people or the animals, the flora, the fauna, and everything else. So we start at the very highest level. And know that architecture has to relate to the law of nature. As we further down, as society developed, as the world developed, we got to the next set of laws. How did the laws create? So, and now we're talking about laws as in my world of laws as opposed to your world of laws. But we had a monarchy. Monarchies was the type of place where they would set up a system where the king or queen made the law, and that was the law of the land, and you had to follow that, which could lead to tyranny or whatever. Then we get into Greek, where we get the pure and complete democracy. That was another type of governmental structure that came about. The problem is it's unworkable when you actually have, depending on how big, as cities and communities come bigger and bigger, you can't really have one person, one vote for every single topic because people just aren't going to be either involved or interested or they can't get in there and vote. But that was the basis of the original democracy in Greece. Now, as we went to Rome and it became a republic, we had senators and everything else, and it became a shift and it was a little bit different. And similar but different than what we currently have now. Other types of laws for people, how they structure governments and how they have societies, there's socialism, communism. There are many, many different types of structures of which laws regulate what the people of the community have to follow. And so these are just some examples of it. We get to where we are now. We live in a world of, we, the United States of America, where most of you guys probably were practicing, but maybe some not. We have a constitutional democracy. So we have a constitution that talks about democracy, but it's set up differently. The majority doesn't always rule. Like if we look at, and I will make this as a caveat. I don't want to get into politics in this class. Sometimes I will use examples of politics to explain a point. But I don't want anybody to be offended one way or the other, so I try to be neutral. You guys may figure out my slant by the time I talk a lot, but I'm trying not to do that. So I say it as a precursor. But where I point about this, the majority doesn't always rule. If you look at our country, if you look just in the most recent presidential election, well, not the recent presidential election, or if you look at previous ones, the most popular vote doesn't always win the presidency. This year, this past election, President Trump won the most number of votes. He had the popular vote. But if you go back to when he won in 2016, he didn't have the most votes. Hillary Clinton had more votes. And if you go back and look at a number of circumstances throughout the years, not just Republican recently, but you can go back to the history of the presidential elections, Democrat, Republican, or even when you go back even further with other parties, the popular vote in the United States doesn't always mean that that is the individual that becomes president. So that's why we have this constitutional democracy where it's a republic and where you have these representatives, and ours is fairly unique and complex of how they put things together and their system of the House of Representatives and the Senate and the Electoral College and all this other stuff. But at the end of the day, and this last bullet point is for all forms of government. You may have a tyrannical king. You may have the democracy of Athens where they fought and argued or whatever. You may have any of these things, but the main theoretical point of laws, and this is the most important on the page, is to protect the rich and the poor, the good and the bad, to protect society. With laws, we have order, we have structures, and with structure and order, we have predictability. There's a quote by Michelangelo, "Without boundaries, man knows no freedoms." And Michelangelo talks about that, and it's applicable to your profession. Obviously, Michelangelo, one of the greatest architects and artists that ever existed. But his philosophy was the boundaries and the parameters by which he was required to paint and sculpt and design forced him to become creative. If he had no boundaries, if there were no guardrails, and he's not just saying that about himself, but everybody in general, if there are no guardrails, things would be all over the map. Imagine if you were able to get on the Kennedy and drive wherever and whatever you want. I mean, today was the first day that I was able to get on the express lanes. I was so excited. But imagine we didn't have any of that stuff. You could drive. You don't have to have stop signs. People get hit in cars. There's all these things that we really don't think about. They're all laws. They're all rules. We had to, like, take a test to study when we're 16, 17, 18, whenever you got your driver's license, so you could drive a car. Those are just laws to protect people. You know, you're like, oh, God, did I get that one right or wrong? It's not about whether you got it right or wrong. It's, are you thinking about general society? That's what the law is. That's what I do. And so whether you have any of these forms, the ultimate there is important. Now, one thing I will say also, and this is where maybe you want to bring a colored Sharpie or whatever, there are going to be times when I'm going to say, hey, this is going to be on the exam. Something like this in that last bullet, there's going to be a question probably about this last bullet on the exam. I'll give you some tips. Not every single time, but there's been one. So you might want to star that on your little sheet if you want to. So, any questions? Okay, so we go here. I talked a little bit about this. We have the national level. There's levels of our government. So now here in the United States, things are national level. It's not federal. We have the federal government, but there are national laws. They're very different. They're federal laws, but they're national things. You can only express things on the national level, exercise that power expressly granted to you in the Constitution. We have a constitutional democracy. So the power of our federal government to issue a law that goes over the nation must be driven or derived from the powers granted in the Constitution, which includes all the amendments. Okay? So that's why we made amendments. We're the first 13 amendments that came out very quickly because they read the Constitution. There's great paper. Needs a lot more. So they had the first 13 amendments. We've subsequently added a number of amendments of different requirements. Some have been repealed. Prohibition. We were not allowed to drink. Then it's been repealed. Prohibition was repealed by the 18th Amendment. I always remember that because when you were 18, certain places you can drink when you're 18. So the 18th Amendment repealed prohibition. So you can have amendments, you can take them back. That's why they're amendments. They change things. But the only way you can have powers that regulate what's going on a national level is through the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution. If it's silent in the Constitution, it falls to the state. Now, some of you guys may have learned this in like civics or government in high school. Maybe you guys took a civics or governmental class in college. Some of this may be repeat. This type of stuff will not be on the exam, but I just want to go over it because I think it sets a parameter for the rest of the test, rest of the semester, because I'll talk about this stuff. I'll flip back to federal law, state law, and this type of things. The Constitution is read extremely broadly. And if you look over the history of the Constitution and how it's been interpreted, it actually, while I say it's broad, It has swung up and down and up and down. Like everything in society, it has waves. And if you look at the more recent rulings and the structure of the court now versus the structure of the court in, say, the 60s and 70s, the 60s and 70s probably were more broadly interpreting and more liberal in their interpretation of the contract, of the Constitution. The current Supreme Court, which is the one that sets the laws at the national level, or interpret the laws at the national level, they don't set them, they interpret them. The current Supreme Court looks a little more fundamental. They go back to the actual written documents that are the basis of the Constitution, not the exact, not just the words of the Constitution, but there are papers written about the Constitution and how they were put together. Some of them are the Federalist Papers. If anybody's seen Hamilton, that's part of it. He wrote, 51 of the 67 Federalist Papers. So a lot of them, they're looking back to Hamilton and seeing what he wrote, what it meant. They're actually going back and saying, this is what they meant. This is exactly what it meant. The flip side argument to that is, how could something that was written in the 1700s, 1800s be relevant to now with society still changing and everything else? And that's always going to be an argument out there. But that's how it's applied, is that you read the Constitution and then you look at the law and you see if it falls within under the umbrella of the Constitution. If it's not there, like I said, it goes to the state level. And so silence in the Constitution and not interpreting, then it's up to the states. And we have a country that is governed by a lot of the laws. They're like, and many times the Supreme Court won't take a case. They're like, this is for the states to figure out. You guys do it. We don't have to. It's not a federal issue. It's not a question for the federal. It's a question for the state. Because, like, if there's a law for architecture written in California about how it's designed for earthquakes, why would that have to apply in Michigan? We're not having earthquakes all the time in Michigan, or Illinois, or West Virginia. So that's a law that's applicable and very required for California, but not for another state that applies to architecture. So states regulate what's going on in the laws in their situations for what's important for those societies, what's important for the populace are, the swing level. I mean, certain states are more liberal, certain states are more conservative, certain states have more interest in agricultural, certain have more interest in manufacturing. It all depends. So, and each state is wholly separate and not obligated to follow the other state laws. So just because you can have I'll use this as an example, again, trying to connect the dots between federal and state. Years ago, you weren't allowed to have single-sex marriages unless you were in a state that allowed that. Massachusetts was one of the early states that adopted single-sex marriages. That eventually was challenged constitutionally, and now, and I don't remember the name of the case that came out of the Supreme Court, it has been allowed. Single-sex marriage is now recognized. Now, it came through as a part of making sure people had equal pay, equal insurance, and other benefits, because you would have a partner that maybe got sick, and that partner couldn't benefit from, like if I had a partner, and I have a wife, but if I have a partner that was my sex, that partner wouldn't be able to have any benefit of the insurance that I had. And maybe that partner is really sick and needs that. So that's the way some of the things got changed to single-sex marriage. Where before, if I lived in Alabama, I couldn't say I'm allowed to have a partner married because Massachusetts is a law. You don't have to follow the state laws. Secondly, with that, the full faith and credit clause in the Constitution requires the state to recognize the validity of another state's decision. So how is that different than a state doesn't have to follow the other state's laws? Well, what it says is and this happens all the time, and you guys will see this, so I always try to turn it back to make it relevant for you in your practice. You're going to enter into contract sometime in the course of your profession, course of your practice, and maybe you or your firm, it may not be you looking at it, but your firm may be obligated to it, and the contract will say, this contract is applicable under the laws of the state of Texas. I had a case like that, where they were building these high-end, upscale log cabins that are not really log cabins, but these mansions and stuff like this. And there was a house where it was so poorly constructed, literally you could hold a candle to the gaps between the logs, and then the wind would blow it out in the winter. So bad. But in that contract, the house was built in Michigan. The contractor was from Michigan. The representative that sold the stuff in Michigan, the architect that worked with the contractor to design all that, they were all from Michigan. The company that supplied the logs was from Texas. We had to apply the Texas law because the contract said the law of Texas is applicable. That comes out of the full faith and credit. If there was nothing in the contract that was silent, it would be the state of Michigan, and Michigan doesn't have to care about Texas. And the company may be from Texas, and we say we don't care. But since the contract instructed it, the full faith and credit clause under the Constitution says if you are instructed, state of Michigan, that it has to be California, Texas law, You got to apply Texas law. And the judges will do that because of that full faith and credit clause. That's the full faith. That full faith and credit clause is in the U.S. Constitution, telling the states how to get along. They don't just necessarily tell you which laws they must be. So it's kind of like the rules to monopoly. The Constitution gives the federal government rules to monopoly, and there are applicable parts in the Constitution that tell the states how to play the rules, how to play monopoly as well. Does that make sense? Okay. Again, same thing. The law here is intended to protect the rich and the poor, designed to allow people to have a say, safety, predictability. What's the future like? That's one, again, in state law. You're going to see it. It's in federal law, too, but I just wanted to repeat it there. And then at the municipal level, we get into, like, the city of Chicago, or one of the examples I always use, there's a city, there's a village, and separate independent taxing bodies. So you have, like, city of Chicago. I live up in the village of Glenview. And then we have these separate independent taxing bodies. I say the MPEA. You guys all know what the Metropolitan Peer Exposition Authority is? Navy Pier and McCormick Place. So Navy Pier, well, originally, the MPEA is created by the state years ago. The state of Illinois said, we're going to have Chicago, big metropolis. There are people wanting to come to Chicago. It's this great city, blah, blah, blah. And you're going to have different types of shows, you know, like the auto show and the consumer electronics show and all these other things that come into McCormick Place. And that's a huge revenue generator. And if it was owned by the city of Chicago and all the taxes that were made from that, because it's not just the show itself, but like people rent hotels. Hundreds and hundreds of, maybe thousands of hotel rooms are booked up when you have these big shows. Restaurants. There's so much money that are generated, so much revenue is generated. If it all went to the coffers of the city, would that be fair? Maybe. But what the legislature did is they said, we're going to create a separate independent taxing body. In fact, the MPEA, McCormick Place and its related buildings, is its own government. They have their own laws. They don't have to follow the laws of the city of Chicago. I mean, some they do, but not all of them. Because, like the state, you don't have to follow every law. So they create their own laws and they create their own taxing authority. That money from taxes actually then gets spread out throughout the state. Now, a lot of it comes to Chicago anyway because there's revenue going to the businesses and otherwise. But you have certain, throughout the country, there are these certain type of municipalities that are not necessarily a village or a city. It's an independent taxing body like the MPEA. So I know a lot through the MPEA because I did. I don't know if any of you guys, when the last time, or if any of you have been out to Navy Pier, they redid that in 2012. It was for their centennial of 2012, the Navy Pier. And I did all the contracts for all that, all the architectural design contracts and all the construction contracts. So anything that was built out there, they called it a horizontal renovation as opposed to vertical because obviously Navy Pier is so spread out. And then during that period of time, actually Navy Pier spun off and became its own separate entity. And so we worked on the papers for that as well. That was kind of cool. But I represented both McCormick Place and Navy Pier for about 15, 18 years and did a lot of stuff with them, helped them build the current convention center, the arena where DePaul plays basketball, and then their 1,200 room hotel. I did all the contracts for that as well. So it's kind of cool. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, there are two then now laws, and again, we're not going to worry about the first one, but there are two different basic parameters of law that we deal with. There's criminal law and there's civil law. I will talk about criminal law from time to time to be able to compare it against civil law, but unless you guys do, like, commit fraud, which is a crime, you don't have to worry about criminal law. Hope you guys aren't cheating people and stealing from people and your clients. It happens. But hopefully you guys never have to worry about this the rest of your careers. But criminal law protects the state. It protects people. And we have the jury system. Now, my tort professor, first year, first class I ever took, he was great. He had his undergraduate degree and master's degree was in child education, like grade school education. And then he went to Michigan Law School and graduated number one in his class. He was brilliant. And he broke things down like a grade schooler would be when he talked about the law. In fact, there's this very famous case called the Paulsgraf case where it's about a woman in a tort and she's on a railroad platform in Pennsylvania, and I don't know if she gets hit by the train or whatever, but she's injured when the train is coming into the station. Very famous, and talks about torts. It's one of the early torts you give. And so when we walked into class today to learn about Paulsgraf, he had this kind of little, he had literally this little little choo-choo train that had like I can't remember the name of the brand, like a Play School choo-choo train, and he had a Barbie doll, and he turned all the lights down, and he had the lights with the flashlight, and that was the tall trap, the train coming in and hitting this tall trap. And he broke things down to these little simple things. I bring that up because he always referred to the jury system as the 12 royal cantaloupes. Now, we have this jury of our peers, but there's not really a true jury of your peers. But we do have this system, and both the jury system in the criminal law and the jury system in civil law is one of the foundation pieces of our jury, of our legal system. That you guys are allowed to be judged by a jury of your peers, as opposed to the tyrannical king, or as opposed to whomever might be the one that makes the decision, thumbs up and thumbs down. So maybe if you haven't seen Gladiator, we probably all know the thumbs up and thumbs down type concept. So, what is a jury of your peers? That comes down to this time of day, this year, this time of life, and everything else. It's kind of what you work with your lawyer to. Do people, like, I've hired jury consultants to get the right type of jury in there. Is it the jury of the peers of my client? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it's the jury for the case. But it is what our Constitution is based on, that you're allowed to have a jury of your peers. In the criminal law system, it's always going to be 12. Well, I think there may be with 6, but I think it's always 12. They're going to have alternates. In the civil system, there's not often where it's going to be 12. Sometimes it'll be 10, sometimes it'll be 6, sometimes it'll be 8. There's going to be different numbers. There's no requirement of the numbers that you're going to traditionally see in a civil case. And you don't have to have a jury in a civil case. Like, if it's a contract case in construction, tip from a lawyer who's been doing this 35 years, don't have a jury if you're in a contract case. Juries would be like, oh my God, all these legalese, and lawyers get it all, and it's really complicated, and they get bored, and you'd rather have a judge doing those decisions. In construction, I stay away from juries. If it's an injury, I go to a jury to play on their emotions. But if it's a business thing, maybe jury is the best thing for you. So, anyway, civil law. Civil law tries to balance the interests of groups and individuals. Is it the needs of the few, the needs of the many, the needs of the one? And they try to balance those things depending on what the law is being created. As I've said a few times, knowing what the law is, having structures and boundaries, guardrails, are good because they ensure predictability. When you are coming to a street and there's a stop sign, the people that are on the other street know you are going to stop. Because there's a law that says if you see a stop sign, you have to stop. It's predictable. If there's nothing there, we are trained in driver's ed to come to a stop and look both ways, and everybody's supposed to stop. But maybe somebody rolls the stop, maybe doesn't, so you don't have the predictability when there's nothing there. And when you're out in the countryside and people are driving at night and you're driving really fast because you're so far away from everything else, you never know what's going to happen. So, and it's not to say that driving the countryside is wrong. It's just you can think about where the boundaries and where the parameters help for predictability. We have two different types of law in the law of civil law. Statutes, and we'll talk about that in the slide coming up, and common law. We'll talk about both of those. So I'm just going to mention those, and we'll get to the slide. And again, we use the jury system as a criminal system, but they're different parameters. Jury system and criminal law, beyond a reasonable doubt, you need to be found guilty. Jury in the civil law is by preponderance. You don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a 51-49 type thing in civil. In criminal, it's 100% of the juries have to say beyond a reasonable doubt. So they all have to say it beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's a different balancing system in there. They're set up in different states and different types of courts of how things are done. So, and you don't have to worry about the specifics of that for the exam. I just wanted to kind of outline that. Okay. I forget her name, when she comes back, tell her, maybe I'll remind her, star this on your page. There will be an exam in the hierarchy of law. It's going to say, which one is higher than the other? Please don't get this wrong. Because it's literally, you go to this lecture, you pull up this page, and it says, where does the administrative orders fall? Is it above or below this one? And you look at it and you get it right. So, mark this one down. But I put it up there because I want you guys to know it. At the very top of the whole list is the Constitution. There's the federal Constitution and there are state constitutions. Every one of our states has their own constitution. They are similar to the U.S. Constitution, but not exact. They may have things that are applicable to the state. They may have a little bit of a structure of how the law is put together. Like, different legislative branches, how the voting is done, how they do things like redistricting. All those things can maybe different coming out of the different constitutions of those states and what the applicability of this is. What you find sometimes is there may be the constitution, like there's been recently in some of the elections, they've created a constitutional amendment that in certain states that allows for abortion. And that's what ended up happening. The Supreme Court took Roe v. Wade and they said, we're going to get back to the states. And they said, we have nothing to do with it. We're not going to look at the constitutionality of it. Before, because of the way Roe v. Wade had been interpreted, you could have had a restriction on in your state, in your constitution, on abortion as a law, and then the Supreme Court could have, if they wanted to, struck it down because it doesn't apply with the way the constitution was being applied there. The Dobbs case have taken that all away and moved it down. That's just the way the law is of land now, and each state can do it. And there have been constitutional amendments where maybe the legislature says abortion is only legal after X, Y, or Z, but the state constitution brings it in and says it's legal all the time. So there's different ways that the constitution brings it in. That's the first level, federal and state. Second level down, in order of priority. So when you're at the constitution, they govern everything. They're the most important, and everything has to fall within those umbrellas. The next one down are statutes. Statutes are created by the legislature. So legislature is Congress, is the House of Representatives and the Senate for terms of our federal government. You always heard of the term, the lawmakers. Senators and congressmen and senators and congresswomen are lawmakers. They are creating what are called statutes. A statute is simply the writing of what the law says. So there's going to be a statute that says you can't run a red light. There's going to be actually, it's a crime to run a red light. You can read it and see what it says. Statutes are created by the legislature. There are federal statutes. There are state statutes. There's county and city. Every single branch of government can create them. If you have a federal statute that says, well, here's an interesting thing. On a federal level, you can't, it's illegal to, at a federal level, to be in commerce with of marijuana. Not commerce, but you can't have, it's not illegalized. Like, smoking marijuana or any type of substance like that is not legal at the federal level. But because it's not specifically stated that it's illegal as a federal law across the country, like Prohibition did, Prohibition was the entire country, there's nothing about that. Each state can have laws that you can have marijuana or hash or whatever for recreational purposes. So Illinois has recently passed that. So that's where the state law, as a statute, is okay because the federal law isn't mandating it. But there is a statute. There are statutes on marijuana in the federal level, like you can't bring them in and import and export. That's why when you hear about drug busts coming in and marijuana coming in because they're bringing it into the country, that's illegal at a federal level. So there's different ways of how certain statutes, the law is written, and some they filter on down as far as priorities. So the federal, then the state, then the city, then the county, and the city. The next one is executive orders. Executive order is going to be provided or created by, if it's a federal level, it's going to be the President of the United States. If it's a state level, it's going to be the governor. If it's a city level, it's going to be a mayor. And maybe some mayors don't have the ability to create an executive order because that has to be legislatively created. So in the U.S. Constitution, you can have executive orders, but it's very narrow. So sometimes presidents have created executive orders and then the Supreme Court has said you didn't have the constitutional power. You have the constitutional power to create executive orders, but only in these areas. So constitutionally, the Supreme Court, sitting up at the Constitution at the highest, came down and said, I looked at your executive order. Yeah, you had the power to do it, but it didn't fit under my umbrella, so you don't have the authority to void that executive order. So again, the hierarchy. After the executive order comes the administrative order. Administrative order is part legislative and part executive. Where that's going to be is a body that regulates your profession. The only profession of the IDPDR is for design and professional responsibility. They have requirements that you need to take so many classes in design and architecture and have so much what they call education in the practice of architecture before you can sit for the ARE. Traditionally, it's 8 years. So when I graduated from architecture school, I had 5 years of schooling. I needed to practice for 3 years under the tutelage of a licensed architect. And that would be considered part of my education to get to my 8 years. And only after those 8 years was I allowed to sit for the ARE. Now, I never practiced. I went straight to law school. But that is created by an executive body. And that executive body, part of the executive branch of the Illinois, or that this was... Yeah, it was Illinois because I moved here right away. that executive body, the Illinois IDPDR, has their own legislative number of people that sit on a council, and they come together and they create a statute. So it's an order, and it applies to specific instances and cases. Each profession, like I have, there's statutes and rules that are applicable to me under the I'm blanking on my governing body, which is terrible. Anyway, there's a similar thing for lawyers that they have to make sure that they follow the rules that falls into the administrative orders and what I have to follow. Okay? Underneath that is what's called common law. Yeah, question.
So for the administrative orders, can those also change state to state?
Without a doubt.
The legislative body
that... Without a doubt, they change from state to state. So we'll go back to the California example. I'll use California as an example for a lot of these differences. California requires when you sit for their AREs, you have to have a full portion of that exam that relates to earthquakes, because of the structure of the country, of the state, and what's going to happen. That requirement is from the California equivalent of the Illinois Department of Special Regulations, the IDPDR. So that is state to state. And another thing is an example. Like, I know for sure in the law, but I imagine it's the same in architecture and other professions. If you want to go, like, as a lawyer, I have reciprocity in a number of Midwest states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, if I practice 5 out of 7 years that I've been out of school. And I don't have to take far. If I want to go become a lawyer in Michigan, I just have to apply, pay a fee, and I'm a lawyer, I'm licensed to practice in Michigan. If I wanted to go to Florida or Arizona or one of the Sunbelt states or California where people like to retire, I have to sit for the bar. It doesn't matter if I've been practicing for 5 years or 35 years. In fact, one of my partners who's been practicing for 37 years just took the bar in Florida. Why? Because he wants to retire there. And so states that have lots of retirees, they want to keep the restrictions of taking business away from the people that actually practice there. They don't want everybody to say, oh, I've been practicing for years, I'm going to be a lawyer in Florida and take business away from people. So they make those regulations harder. So the passage rate for the test, you may be able to take the bar in Illinois, and if you get a 70%, you pass. That same bar in Florida, you may need an 85. And that's all regulated by administrative order and that stuff. So, okay? All right. Common law. Common law are cases that are made in court. So the Paulsgraf case, the one I mentioned, Ms. Paulsgraf, she sued the train station, the train company, because of her injuries, and she relied on the fact that she was injured and that the said that the train company owed a duty of safety and care to her, and her injury was a result of their failure to apply to that. Well, like, what's the duty? Is there a statute that specifically says how the train was supposed to go down the track or how the platform was supposed to be built? At the time, there wasn't. But she was injured. She had a tort. So she brought a claim. It went to the court. They read the facts. And then they talked about the concept of owing a duty to the public, safety, predictability. And they wrote a case about it. And that became common law. So common law has been around for years. I mean, long before our constitutional system and before judges and stuff. Common law actually starts way back in the feudal system where a king would do thumbs up, thumbs down, or say no. And that became the common law of the land. But as society grew and fairness became as important, then you started to have councils and committees and the wise people of the group or whatever you have, like the Council of Elders. I've done some work for... I can't remember the name of the Indian race. There was an Indian nationality that I did some work for a number of grain elevators and construction, like big construction stuff. They didn't have to follow any of the laws of that state. They had their own laws. Their land was sovereign. Their land was theirs. And they were run by a council of elders. And so that council of elders created the laws, and then we had to argue in front of the council of elders, as opposed to here's a statute, and here's a judge, or here's a jury. We had to present to the council of elders, and they were able to approve or disapprove the construction of a grain elevator. I mean, it was a multi-million-dollar project. But so that's all based on common law, the people, the common, and how. Common law changes over the years, too. You may have protecting society about stuff before that's not relevant now. So sometimes laws become archaic and out of date. I actually won a case, and I'm very good friends with my opposing counsel, with a theory of law that was from 1905, and we argued in front of this judge down in Kankakee, this kind of really nice judge. He had this, I can still remember it vividly, his bench was way high, so you had to look up at him, and he was military, and he had this brush cut, flat top, And I walked in to the Chicago lawyer, and everybody knew everybody, and I was like, the Chicago lawyer. Luckily, my opposing counsel was also a Chicago lawyer. If I was arguing from one of the locals, I would have been crushed. So two Chicago lawyers step up, and the first thing I notice, sitting on the judge's bench, is a hand grenade. And from the pin that you pull, it's got this little thing that says, take a number. I'm like, oh my God, Mike, what am I doing here? But we argued this case, and I argued something from 1905. And my opposing counsel, like I said, we're very good friends. She was like, what are you doing? This is like in 97 or 98. She's like, you're pulling a case that's 100 years old. And I'm like, but it worked. So that one stayed around. But some cases in common law goes away just because of society and life and changes. So, next under common law, contracts and agreements. So we have contracts that we write, and it's an agreement between you and me. And we make our own agreements. Now, we can't write something between you and me that says that ignores the statutes and laws and common law. But if we write something that isn't the same or isn't mentioned in common law or statutes, it's okay. Like if my contract says with you, we're going to use the laws of the state of Texas, even though everybody involved is in Michigan, since our contract said that, that's okay, because Michigan, in this case that I had, didn't have anything above that that said you can't do that. In fact, the U.S. Constitution said you can because of the full faith and credit clause. So, you could be way down, way, way down here on the list of hierarchy, and it could still be the law of the land, because you wrote a contract with it. Final thing is custom and practice. One thing that's great about contracts is it writes down what the rules of the game are. Everybody knows what they're supposed to do, right? No. There are so many things that you can't put in a contract, because if I'm building a house and I put every single thing about the construction of that house in that contract, for my $300,000 house, the contract would be 300,000 pages long. You can't put everything in. So in the construction industry, there's custom and practice. This is what a contractor is expected to do. This is what an architect is expected to do. So that custom and practice filters in, and it becomes part of common law. It becomes ultimately a statute, or it's just out there, we're all expected to do that. When you come to that street without the stop sign, we are all taught to stop and look both ways, even if two cars are coming at the same time. We are also to expect that if one car just is about 2 or 3 seconds ahead of us, you wait longer till they pass. That's custom and practice. There's no law that says that. That's custom and practice. But that law, that common law, that custom and practice applies and is the laws of that intersection. Everybody knows at that point in time. Okay? When you were out, I forgot to say, maybe you're still here, but this page you got to highlight, because there's going to be a question on the exam about it. So, okay. Any questions on this? All right, claims. We talked a little bit about claims, so I'm going to try to get through this. Because there are claims, people get injured, there's breach of contracts, there's criminal stuff, we need laws. The parameters, the setting things. Again, civil and criminal. There can be criminal claims, there can be civil claims. Criminal claims, this class I said we're going to mostly do civil claims. We're going to talk about claims against design professionals, architects and engineers, owners, contractors, subcontractors, consultants, and others. The people that are in the triangle of the construction industry. What is a claim and how is it resolved? There are different types of claims, and we'll talk about resolution, one of them being when we get their dispute resolution. Two categories of claim. We talked about tort, but I'll bring it up again. Tort and contract. What makes up a tort claim? A tort claim is an injury which could include a trespass, could include kidnapping, although that's a criminal claim as well, but you can actually bring a tort claim against someone if you've been kidnapped. So not only do you have that person can go to jail, but if you recover funds from that. Then there's a breach of contract claim. One of the most famous, I mean, this goes way back, but and so you guys may have much less knowledge of it than I do, but like one of the most famous tort claims in the U.S. history over the last 20 years is the O.J. Simpson case. O.J. Simpson was found not guilty by a jury of his peers for the crime of killing Nicole Brown Simpson, his wife. God forbid if he had killed Nicole Kidman. Anyway, Nicole Brown Simpson, he was found not guilty by a jury of his peers of killing Nicole Brown Simpson. There was not enough evidence to prove that he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But the Brown family brought a civil lawsuit for the tort against O.J. Simpson, claiming damages for the death of their daughter. they prevail because it wasn't by reasonable doubt, it was by preponderance of the evidence. That was a tort. It's based on an alleged crime of which he was found not guilty. But the injury that was suffered by the family allowed them to bring a tort claim under that theory. There's no contract, it was just, I was injured, my daughter's dead. So that's where they got that. That was the basis of that claim. So that's very famous, where you can have criminal and the person's found not guilty and you can still recover in a civil case. What makes a contract claim? Contract claim is we have a written agreement or oral agreement between one or more parties, or two or more parties. So I can be in a contract with one other person, I can be in contract with a group of people. An entity can be in contract with multiple people, depending on how the structure is put together. So it's contract, it's an agreement between two or more people that's oral or written, and one of the parties fails to provide what their obligations are under the agreement. So I file a breach of contract claim. I'm going to design a building for you, and you're going to pay me $10,000 for my design services. You paid me $8,000. I'm going to sue you for $2,000 because I designed the building and you didn't fulfill all of your contract. You're going to say, well, I didn't like your drawings and you were late on the delivery and I'm not going to build this house, so I'm only going to give you $8,000 because that's what I think it's worth. I don't care. We have a contract that says you owe me $10,000. That's a breach of contract claim. Does that make sense? So, tort doesn't have to be written. Tort can come out of common law. Tort can come out of statute. Tort is an injury. Contract is a breach between two parties of written agreement. There are damages in both sides. So, okay, duty. You have to have a claim. You have to have a duty. What is my obligation? Question.
Quick question on the tort case. Are damages monetary?
Great question. That's excellent. So the question is, and sometimes I'm going to repeat a question, not just because you guys may not have heard it, but because if you ever want to listen to this again, you're not going to hear the person in the audience. So the question was, is are damages always monetary or can they be something else? The answer is yes. They can be something else. I'll give you an example of a case that I was on. And it was based on a breach of contract claim, but we didn't bring it as a contract claim. I had a client that they were a nationally known lighting manufacturer and installer. And part of the services is they would work together with the architect and they would bring in their own designers when they were going to do like ceiling plans and layouts and everything else because there were some complex lighting systems. And this was a project that was underway and it was very, very complex, lots of stuff in it. And the lighting company was owed $450,000. Nobody was paying their bills. And what ended up happening was the owner were getting in trouble financially and they didn't want to pay the architect, and so they hired a new architect and they took the pages from the architect's drawing and put the new architect put their letterhead on the title block and started using the design. Now, I didn't represent the architect. I didn't care about all the rest of the stuff. I cared about my client, and in those designs were my client's reflective ceiling designs, and my client was owed $450,000. I couldn't bring a breach of contract against the architect. I could have brought a breach of contract against the architect, but the architect didn't infringe on my drawings. I had a relationship with them. They owed me money, but they were owed money from the owner, and the owner wasn't paying them. I couldn't sue the architect that took my drawings. I could have maybe sued them specifically for copyright infringement, but there was too many layers to get to them, and I didn't have a contract with them. So I filed and tried to get my $450,000. That would have been my monetary claim. What I did is I filed for a preliminary injunction and a temporary restraining order with the federal court, and I said, this project, and I named the owner, and I named the other architect, and I named the other lighting designer, the company that came in and took our stuff. I named them in the case, but the case was saying, my copyright, which is a federal law based out of the U.S. Constitution, copyrights and patents are in the Constitution, my client designed this reflective ceiling, and has not been paid, and they are infringing on my drawings. And I bring this up because this is applicable to you. Your drawings are your babies. Your drawings are your lifeblood. And so we shut down the project. We said, if this project continues using our drawings, that's an infringement, and I can get statutory damages under the copyright law and some other stuff. But we were not asking at the time for monetary damages. We just shut down the project. 2 weeks later, we got paid. Because the owner couldn't afford to have his project shut down. So we used it not to get monetary damages, but we used it to stop an injunctive relief, and we brought it as a claim for tort. Copyright infringement is a tort. So, it's based off the statute, but it is a tort because you have taken something from me. Stealing, conversion, copyright infringement, those can be considered a tort, not necessarily breach of contract. So, that was an example of what we did, but we didn't get money. We got paid, but it wasn't the purpose of the lawsuit of what we were trying to get recovered. We recovered the injunction. We stopped the project. That led to payment. They were like, oh my God. So, you can get difference. There are other things too, but that's like the best and quickest example I can give you. But no, it doesn't have to always be monetary. Duty. So duty is created by law, contract, or otherwise. The duty is, what do I owe you? What are the responsibilities? The statute may say you have to stop at the stoplight. Or the contract may say you have to pay me $10,000 for the design of your house. Otherwise, maybe just what industry custom and practices are. There may be duties to say, when I am building something, it has to be done safely. I don't walk around without hard hats on a construction site. Those types of things where you have, it may not be written in OSHA, it may be, but there are some things that are industry custom and practice. The duty is, what obligation do you owe the other people on the project or in the contract or just walking around? Like, again, stopping at an intersection where there's no stop signs. If somebody gets there first, your duty is to let them go first. You must stop too. You can't just blow through because they're stopped. That's a duty you owe them. And if you fail to perform that duty, then you have breached your duty to society and they can sue you for a tort. Breach of the duty. That's the failure to perform that duty. I didn't do it. I didn't stop at the stop sign. I didn't pay you my full $10,000. Whatever it might be. It's performing in a manner that is not consistent with the standard of care. Now, the standard of care is something that you guys want to remember throughout. I will talk about it a lot of times. Standard of care is very important for what you guys do. Standard of care falls into the world of custom and practice. What is expected for a professional architect to do? You have a standard of care as an architect. It's different than the average Joe or Jane walking on the street. What is my standard of care as a lawyer? I, when I talk to a client, am looked at as a professional. So if that same person came to you and asked a question, do you think I have a case here? And you said, absolutely. And then they came to me and I said, no. The one that they are allowed to rely on the standard of care is me. And if it was absolutely, and I said no, I may have breached my standard of care to them, and then I could potentially sue for malpractice. Doesn't matter if you said yes or no, because you're not held to that of a legal standard. Same thing the opposite. If someone came to you and asked you guys something about how a building was put together, and then you asked your neighbor, the neighbor wouldn't be held to any standard, unless they were an architect, but you would. So, does that make sense? Standard care? Question?
What are the standards of care based on?
Good question. The standards of care for your profession are based largely on common law, industry custom and practice, and statutes. And what ends up happening is industry custom and practice leads to common law, and so the hierarchy goes backwards. Everybody does the same thing over and over and over. Oh, let's create law about that. And when somebody doesn't do the same thing, it isn't predictable. So we go to court and we get a lawsuit and we get a judgment. And there's a written example that becomes common law. And then all of a sudden you have common law over and over and over and over, and have a whole bunch of laws that different courts are doing, and the legislature's like, oh, we should codify that. Let's just put it into a statute. And so it goes, and by the time it gets to a statute, or maybe even an amendment where we get prohibition or the repeal of the prohibition, it can get to an amendment that then covers everything going downstream. But it starts from the bottom up, that standard of care. It's that basic premise of the law to protect the rich and the poor and safety and predictability. That's where it starts. Question?
For the standard of care, you mentioned malpractice, but on the neighbors, over the fence,
So the question is your neighbor comes to you and asks you questions about an addition they're putting on the house, and you're not retained by them, you're not their architect, but you're good friends, you're drinking a beer in the backyard, you say, what do you think of this? Will it stand up? Are they doing it right? And you say, yes, it looks fine to me. Are you going to be held liable when that building falls down? There are two words that everybody hates the lawyer says, and we say it all the time. It depends. Now, there's what's called the Good Samaritan Law. So if someone's injured on the street and a doctor or a nurse comes up and helps them, can they be sued if they commit malpractice and a failure to perform under that? Or are they being a good Samaritan? And the answer is depending on what you're doing, you could be sued, and so could you, depending on what you became involved in. Now, what I am always counseled as my, like, lawyers have lawyers. Like, there are three lawyers at my law firm that our law firm are our lawyers. So every month we get a new professional responsibility requirements and stuff. But what you're always counseled is, when you are talking to a client, whether they're a friend or otherwise, you must think and consider that you are acting in the capacity as an attorney. Even if you don't believe that you are. Even if you say to them, I am not giving you legal advice right now. It becomes difficult. Now, I've had many people that have called me over the years and said, hey, I got your name out of the phone book. What do you think we can do? What do you think about that? And I will say, I just need you to know until I'm retaining you, I can't give you any legal advice. But here's some things you might want to think about. Without giving them advice, you give them suggestions. So it depends on what you say to them. If you walk around and say, yeah, this looks good, you may be liable. If you say, you know what, if I was doing this, is your contractor doing this? Have you talked to your architect about this? And if you get some answers from them and you say, well, that seems like a reasonable thing, but you might want to check up with that, you may not be liable for that. Does that help? You had a question back there. Oh, I thought you did. Sorry. Okay. Anything else on this? Okay. Okay, these are all elements of claim. So the next element is an injury. You have to have an injury. Like, if I came to that stop sign, that intersection, and the other car stopped, and I just blow through it, that other car can't sue me because I didn't follow the custom and practice. Even if there was a stop sign, or a stoplight, and I blow through it, they can't sue me for breaking that law. Now, the state could if they have a camera, because I broke a state law, but the individual can't bring a claim against me unless they are injured. And a tort and injury would be physical, it could be trespass, it could be kidnapping, it could be conversion, there's a whole list of them. We'll go through those in a later lecture. But you have to have an injury. You have to have a duty, breach of duty, injury. And damages is the other one. So you have to have some type of damages. Those are both for torts and contracts. You have to have some type of injury. In the contract, the injury is, after the breach of contract, is the building fell over, or I paid too much money for this, or you didn't pay me enough. I was damaged by those, you paid me $8,000 instead of $10,000, I had a $2,000 damage. So that word injury, if there's a contractual loss, quickly goes into damage. Now the connection between this two, this causation, is also very important. Was the injury caused by the failure of the other party to perform their duty? So I'll give you an example. You are hired as a lighting consultant to design the lighting systems for an office building. You design the lighting systems. And there are problems with the electrical system in the bathroom such that the hair dryer doesn't work. And it shorts out, and you get electrocuted. There's a duty that you have to do your lighting system correctly. That lighting system, though, is not related to the electrical system necessarily for the hair dryer. Is there a causation? Maybe you failed to do the lighting system. Maybe what happened is you walked into the room, the lights didn't go on, you were feeling around, you touched the hair dryer on the wall, and that's what electrocuted and shorted you out. So you failed to perform your duty and the lighting system didn't work. But if there's no causal connection between the hair dryer that electrically shorted out and your lighting system, you had a duty, you breached the duty, there was an injury, got electrocuted, damages, I got to get surgery to fix my hand or whatever it is, but there is no causation, there is no connection between the two. Now, you might get an expert to come in and say, well, the reason why the hair dryer shorted out is because the way they wired it for the light, that was the problem. That creates a causal connection. But if it's not connected, just because the lights didn't go on and off, if there was an electrocution in the hair dryer, there is no causation. Was the injury or loss caused by the breach of duty? So you can have a duty, you can have a breach of duty, you can have an injury, you can have damages, you can have all those things, but if there's no causal connection, you do not have a claim. Does that make sense? And that's what often happens, like in a breach of contract claim too, is they say the owner has the building, the wall falls down, and they sue the architect, and they sue the contractor, and the architect says, my designs were fine, they built it wrong. And the contractor says, my building was right, they designed it wrong. Well, what we're going to try to do is sort out what was the cause of the wall falling down. It could be both. It could be one. If it's one, then I don't have a claim. If it's the construction, I don't have a claim against the architect. That goes away, even though there was a duty, breach duty, everything else. If it fell down because they built it wrong, even if you designed it incorrectly, but they still built it wrong, that could be no causal connection. So there's different ways you have to look at cause. Questions? Okay. Damages, again, there's an injury, loss, or cost. And the last one here, you have to have all the elements. Duty, breach, injury, cause, damages. If you don't have all those, you can't recover on a claim under our society. Now, the old school, eye for eye. You know what? Somebody got their hand cut off, they cut off your hand. They didn't have to necessarily have monetary damages or other things like that, but there used to be this eye for an eye. That's not the way we are. We have these legal methods, and sometimes statutes say how much you can recover. Sometimes the common law, you hear about these jury verdicts in the hundreds of millions of dollars and things, sometimes in the billions of dollars, like the ones when you're dealing with like Apple and Microsoft and some of those infringement cases. They're massive. So that's how we work through as far as claims. Any questions? Okay. So we have these claims. Whether it's a tort, I'm against you because you injured me, whether it's a contract, you owe me that $2,000 on that construction contract or the design contract, how do we resolve that? So this is more parameters. This happens in every type of world as far as the legal world in our systems, but this is really applicable, very applicable in the construction industry. You're going to do binding where whatever the person that's making the decision, judge, jury, arbitrator, that decision is binding on you and you must comply with what that decision is. Or non-binding. Non-binding means you kind of try to work it out as a business resolution. Both of these are very important and very applicable in the construction industry. So we have, on the binding side, we have litigation. Litigation, when you hear I'm a litigator, I go to court. That's all about being in the court. Litigation is the court. That's the most traditional method that's been around for hundreds of years. We go to a judge or a jury. The problem with being in litigation is it's really time-consuming and really expensive because of all the safeguards and protections and lawyers making more safeguards and protections and creating work that shouldn't be done and everything else. And so when you get hired by, when your lawyer hires you, it's really expensive. In fact, like I said, a lot of times people call me. They're like, I looked you up. I saw you I saw your name in when I looked up construction law and I wanted to know I had this problem with my house. And the first thing I ask them, like, what's wrong with your house? And they tell me. And I'm like, because I've been doing this a long time, I'm thinking in my head, it's about a $200,000 issue. That's really a big deal for you. I mean, it's huge. Like, I built this $500,000 house, and I got a roof at least, and I got some other stuff, so it's like $200,000. That's a lot of money to come in and have it prefixed. And then I say to him, I'm like, if we go and file a case in court, let me see your contract doesn't have an arbitration clause, if we go file this case in court, it may cost you double the $200,000 to take it all the way through court and get a jury decision or a judge decision. Do you really want to do that? Is it worth it to spend that? Or do you want to just hire a contractor, a new one that's better, and I'll give you some names, and you go hire them, and you don't pay me a lot of money. You pay them, and you get this thing, and you move on with your life. Litigation is expensive. It's really expensive. But sometimes you have to do it. And that gives you a binding decision. At the end of the day, the judge or jury is going to say, yes, they screwed up in the construction of your house, you're owed $200,000. You've written me checks for $385,000, you get $200,000 back and you're now $185,000 in the hole. Like, was it worth it? Some people do that. Some people do it out of principle. Okay? They do it. Some people do it because it's a wash. Maybe it's close. You know, there's all different things to do. You have to make those decisions, and those are hard personal decisions. I help counsel people that call me and my clients on that. So a lot of times, I work for a large firm. So as a large firm, my rates are way too high. I will refer them to my colleagues that are at small firms and have lower rates and say, this guy's really good or this woman's really good. Go to them. They'll take care of you and you can use them instead of me and tell them that you know me and hopefully you can get it done for cheaper than what I could be. So just depends. Arbitration. Arbitration is another binding type of resolution. So you guys want to remember, by the way, just remember these, litigation, arbitration, mediation for the exam. Kind of remember the concepts that I'm talking about here. Arbitration is also binding. Arbitration is only by agreement. So your contract, whether it's oral or written, has to say, we don't want to go to the courts because it's cumbersome and it takes a long time and going to Cook County is a nightmare. We want to have an arbitration, so we're going to have a panel of one or three, and those individuals are going to decide our case. Now, their decision is going to be binding like a judge or jury is, but we want to do it kind of in a private fashion. We don't want it to be splashed all over the headlines because once you're in court, it's public knowledge. Arbitration should be private. Nobody can hear about it. Some of the problems with arbitration is there is no right of appeal. Whatever the panel says, the arbitration panel says, you have to abide by that, even if they got it wrong under the law. So that's a big problem with arbitration, is it's not binding. So we have both, to get into arbitration, you must agree at the beginning, or at the end, you can agree right before you go to court. Say, hey, let's not go to court, should we arbitrate? And maybe you can get the parties to agree. You must have that in writing. You can't just say it, because if you don't have it in writing, people are like, I don't remember you saying that, so you should have it in writing. And you're stuck with the version of whatever the panel says. There's no appeal. There's no secondary process. You can't go further and say they got it wrong. That's the two main problems with arbitration. But it happens all the time. It can be done faster and cheaper. Sometimes I have been involved in an arbitration over the last 7 years for a large case. It's not faster or cheaper. Actually, it's coming on 8 years. And the wash for the client probably will not be the recovery that they want because of so long and so many dollars spent. But that was what the contract required us to do. We couldn't do anything else. We could try to settle, but the parties wouldn't settle, so we have to battle it out. It's going to be binding. Non-binding. Negotiation. You can always just have the business people talk to each other and see if you can work things out. Normally, by the time I'm called, either the people hate each other from the last movie and they don't want to talk to each other, or they try to talk and they haven't been able to figure it out. So they come to me. The negotiation, like I said, is limited to the skill and the attitudes of the parties, so you may not be the best negotiators, or one person may be in a very larger advantage position. There's a big company and a little company, those types of things. So negotiation may not be successful. So you would go to mediation. Mediation, like arbitration, must also be by agreement. Should be in writing. You can agree to it later on, but it's always best to do it in the beginning when you have a contract with the party. So mediation by agreement. And it's often faster and cheaper than other methods because it's non-binding. So you don't have to go through all of the history and all of the documents and all the depositions and all the expense of the case. You can try to hire a couple experts. You can get to the surface level issues, maybe get to narrow down a couple of the meaty ones. And then you present it in a mediation, you present it to a mediator. The mediator is a neutral that does not have power over every party. The mediator will say, I think this case is worth $1 million to party A. And party A can say, I think it's worth $3 million, you're full of it. Or party B can say, I'm not paying $1 million, you're full of it. And neither party has to be settled or agree with the $1 million because it's non-binding. But what often happens with a good mediator is they say that $1 million, and that good mediator comes to my client that wants $3 million and says, you're going to spend $2 million in litigation fees and you may not get $3 million. In fact, I don't think you're going to get more than $1.5 million in front of a jury. You want to spend $2 million in legal fees and recover $1.5 million and then be down all those dollars you paid Mr. Hanahan, who's great and he's going to tell you all the good things, but do you really want to pay him, or do you want to just take $1 million from these guys right now? That's what a mediator will do, and the mediator will go to the other side and say, I know you don't want to pay them $1 million, but you're going to spend, to this other lawyer here, you can pay her $2 million in legal fees, and then you're going to be paying that $1 million, so now you're $3 million in the hole. Which do you really want to do? So the mediator, while they're not have binding power, they are the skilled negotiator that gets the deal done. So those are the ways you solve lawsuits, solve disputes. Litigation, arbitration, negotiation, mediation. All different facets. And I try to employ almost all of them in all my cases. Because it's important to get things done. Like, that's my job. Okay. Let's talk about anatomy of lawsuit. The lawsuit, like I said, is litigation. And then we'll get to, at the very end of the class, we'll get to mediation and arbitration. Anatomy of lawsuit. The first thing that happens when there's a claim is there's a plaintiff. The plaintiff, sometimes used with the pi symbol, the plaintiff is the party that is injured. The plaintiff is the party that has either been physically injured or the contract was breached. They are the ones that says, you owe me something. Okay? What they do is they hire a lawyer. This is for the lawsuit, not for the arbitration mediation. But they hire a lawyer. If it's an individual case, if you were the one that was stepping off the curb and you got hit by a car, you could bring as an individual, which is called pro se. It's one of those Latin terms. But only individuals can represent themselves. Like, you can't have a company that's represented by an individual. Or you can't have, I can't represent my sister as if I'm not retained as her lawyer. So you always have to have a lawyer for other people or companies. Pro se is only for individuals. You file an appearance in front of the court. You say, I'm appearing on behalf of Mike Hanahan, or Mike Hanahan is appearing on behalf of Jones Company for this lawsuit. So I file an appearance, the company's listed, and I have this complaint which writes out in legal terms what the claim is. Mike Hanahan was hired by Jones Company. Mike Hanahan was supposed to design this building. Mike Hanahan was supposed to be paid for this. See the contract attached. This is what happened over the course of the period of time. Here's all the things that Mike did. Here's all the things that the other company did. But they didn't do X, Y, and Z. So that's the duty, the breach of duty. They should have been paid. It was because we did the work and they didn't pay us. That's the causation, that's the connection, and here's the damages. That's going to be written out in a complaint, and you serve that. You've probably seen TV and stuff, they're like, oh, you've been served. So that's actually the service of the summons. If you have now got a complaint, the defendant is often shown by the term as a delta, which is like a triangle. So plaintiff is pi, defendant is a delta triangle. So the defendant has to respond. So they file their own appearance. So they have Bob Jones' lawyer be on behalf of, you know, the company that was being sued. They file a motion to dismiss. It's not the right company. You got the wrong name of the company. Or your lawsuit doesn't have enough facts. Or there's no law to support you. They may file a motion to say, your lawsuit should go away. We want to dismiss you. That happens sometimes, not always. Sometimes they just file an answer. Deny, 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 deny. We didn't do this, we didn't do this, we don't do this. So not only do we not owe them money, they owe us money because they did, but Mike Hanahan did a crappy job as the architect, whatever that might be. Sometimes they can say affirmative defenses. Not only do we not owe money, and not only do they owe me money, but here's all the things that he did wrong too. So they will come back and kind of throw some shade on you. They will throw stuff at you to say what you did wrong. They will have their own kind of complaint, and that could lead to a counterclaim. We paid Mike $8,000. The value of Mike's work is only $4,000. I don't owe him $2,000. He owes me $4,000. I have a counterclaim. So that's what you create. So you have the complaint and the summons, and then you have the answer from the defendant. Questions on that? Yes?
In the story you're saying you've got the wrong party, are you then saying who's the actual party that
you're
saying, or
are you
saying we're wrong party at that?
So, it depends. Sometimes you want to, if you know for sure it's the wrong party and you want to get them off your trail right away, you point them in the right direction because that's expedient for your client. Other times when maybe it's because you changed the name of your corporate entity and now you're being a little bit crafty because this LLC wasn't that LLC and they sued the wrong LLC, then you just say, you sued the wrong company and you make them go find it. So it depends on what the circumstances are. And trust me, I've been in both. Both sides too. Where I've had to tell my client we should tell them, but sometimes I'm like, let's just not tell them and see if they figure it out. And then I've sued people where they had to make us chase them.
So if you change your name and you say we're not the same company,
mm-hmm.
and they find out that you're the same company there and you change your name, does that not look bad to you?
Well, it could be that you're two different companies and then they sue the second company, but you're still the president of both companies. Or it could be, and that this is a case that I've had recent involvement with, it could be that they changed the name and it's clear not only that they changed the name because they were in this massive lawsuit, but that they still commingled funds and who they were paying. So like Company A was paying employees of Company B with funds from Company A. So then you have where they're commingled, and then you can go after A and B. But then you have to file a pierce of the corporate veil, and it's a whole separate lawsuit, and blah, 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 blah. But yes, you can have people where they get in trouble because they're just trying to dodge the responsibility. So, there is nothing, by the way, I thought that that's a nefarious kind of thing. There is nothing wrong with having Company A created and building a house or a building, and then the next building is Company B, and then Company C. In fact, that's what LLCs are about. We won't talk about that today, but that happens all the time. And so sometimes you are improperly sued. Maybe A was sued and it should have been B and it could have been a mistake. Well, you don't want to put them onto B when you were sued by A, but the reality is that's not wrong. Where it becomes wrong is if you're doing it to hide, if you're commingling, it depends on the characters that are creating separate companies. Many businesses, especially in the construction industries, have a new LLC for every single project. That's totally fine. In fact, recommended in a lot of instances because you compartmentalize from project to project. So it doesn't have to be a nefarious scenario, and it could be just a mistake in being sued to the wrong company. So, okay, next stage. Pre-trial discovery. Okay, this is the most expensive part of litigation. So they call it pre-trial. It's before you actually go to trial, before you go to court, the judge and the jury, whatever it might be, you have to do what's called discovery. Discovery is to learn about all the facts. Why did that wall fall down? Was it a bad design? Was it bad construction? Was it both? Was it improper soils? Oh my God, I sued the architect, I sued the engineer, or the contractor. I didn't sue the soil engineer that I hired somewhere else with the architect, nothing to do with it. Did I hire the right person? So in the course of discovery, you learn about the facts of the case. How do you learn about the facts of the case? You send them to a request in writing that says, give me all the documents that are related to this case. Now that's the 50,000 foot level. You have a very specific list of types of documents you want. Sometimes you fight about it and say the list is too general, whatever it might be, but ultimately documents are exchanged between the parties, and then there's what's called interrogatories. Interrogatories are written questions that are very specifically written, and they're not written to necessarily catch you. It's not a gotcha question, but it is, the questions are written to try to hone and narrow down the issues in the case. And so you write very specific, and that's the art of a legal interrogatory. You write these questions to try to lock the other party in. It could be assumed as gotcha, but you're just trying to, everything is done by under oath and sworn, so you write a question that should get a good answer, but you're trying to do is, this discovery is learn about the case in writing, in questions, and then you get the depositions. What ends up happening is you read all the documents and you get the, like literally, I've been on cases with over a million pages of documents, a number of those cases. But hundreds of, in the construction industry, hundreds of thousands of documents is very common. And you want to whittle those down to the end of the day when you finally get to trial to about 200 or 300 from literally hundreds of thousands of the most important key documents. The discovery process teaches you how to whittle that down. And part of it is when you're getting this 100,000 documents, when you get to deposition, you're down to probably like 30,000 documents. And then you have to figure out of those documents, depositions is the oral question and answering where they sit in front of you. There's a court reporter. They're under oath. And you ask them questions and you put documents in front of them. And then you get answers to some of those documents and then you realize you don't need to use this or this whole grouping of documents, and so you compare things down to your key documents. Now, again, it could be like I had a big trial many years ago, and we got our key documents down to about like 1,500. So it doesn't have to always be like 200, but this was a 3-week trial in federal court and we were down to about 1,500 documents. So, but you don't want to have, I mean, you can't bring in 10,000 documents to a judge or jury to see it. They just won't look at them. They'll get bored and think about how much time it would be to put them all in. So this discovery process is narrowing it down to what the key facts of the case are about. Sometimes, if Mike Hanahan is suing Jones Company, there may be another company over here, another entity over there, another architect, another engineer, another contractor, whatever, that are important because maybe they were the electrician that did the work on the job, and I'm suing only the general contractor because that was the relationship with the contractor. You want to get information from them so you can serve subpoenas to third parties. Third parties are people that are not named in the lawsuit, but have pertinent information. And a subpoena is to say, here's a subpoena, you've been served a subpoena, you need to either give me these documents, could be written production requests, or appear for this deposition and I'm going to ask you questions about the case. They need to be important and need to be important and related to the case, but that's what happens with third party subpoenas when you can get additional information, discovery from them. Discovery is very long. Like an average case in Cook County is about 3 years from filing the complaint to actually getting assigned a trial judge. Actually, I think it's longer than that. I think it's probably 4 or 4.5. And during that period of time, it's learning and reading facts and taking depositions and everything else. It's just a ton of time and a ton of work, and it takes a long time. And that's a lot of why people want to go to mediation and arbitration, because it gets to the meat of things faster. And then there's this thing called motion practice, and I file this motion, it says, oh, you haven't said this right, or you haven't done this. There's all these different, I'm not going to get any of the nuances in the motion, but that's what happens during the discovery process, and the parties do that again to narrow down the issues, so when they finally get to the trial, they can kind of like, here's the capsule, here's the key parts. So, as I said, this is the most expensive and longest portion of any lawsuit. Whether it's arbitration, litigation, either way, it's going to be extremely expensive. Question? So the question is in discovery, are they required to give up the documents? The answer is yes. So what happens sometimes, and I've had this in many cases, is they give you, you send your production request, send me documents relating to A, B, C, D, E, and F. And they only give you A and B. And then you're like, I know there's C, D, E, and F. I know there's that there because I've seen similar documents on my client's side because they have these documents. I want to see your backup. Like, I have an invoice from you that talks about these things that you provided me, but I want to see your timesheets. I want to see who was doing the work. I want to see when you were out of the project site and what you did during that time. You gave me the invoice just like my client has. That's an A and D. Where's C, D, E, and F? And you're like, well, I don't really think I have to give this to you. Then I file a motion to compel against you. And then you go in and the judge says, it looks like he's got a reasonable argument there. Give him C, D, E, and F. And then maybe you give me C and D. You don't give me E and F. And then I got to file a motion for compel again. And then we go back to the judge. And the judge is like, what are we doing here? And then I say, and if I'm back again, judge, they're like, got to give those documents to Mr. Hannigan. 30 more days. And then I have to go back again. Then I file a motion for sanctions. I've now had to come to court 3 times to get A through F. When all the time they should have given me A through F. The judge has said it, they've ordered you twice, you failed to produce all the time. I'm spending my client's money. I want the money for this motion, this motion, this motion. So I backdate it. And I say, I want $10,000 for all the work that I had to get where I shouldn't have had to do anything because they're obligated to give it to me. And the judge will be like, most of the time, give them the documents or the next time you're up, I'll give you sanctions so you don't get sanctions the first time. Sometimes you'll get sanctions. It depends on what the court is and the judge is. But yes, you have to. And if you get a subpoena, you have to produce those. In our actuaries, you have to. People play games all the time, though. So. Any other questions on discovery? Then we get to trial. That's where everybody gets to wave their hands and get to be like you see on TV and everything else. During trial, we talked about the 12 royal cantaloupes. Again, no disrespect. That's just because of what my professor called it, so that's what I always think. Or bench trial. Bench trial is that judge that sat up there with the hand grenade that's to take them. And they make the decision. The judge makes the decision. So there's the trier of fact and the trier of law. The law, the trier of law is always the judge. They are going to know the law and interpret the law. The trier of fact is the jury that hears all the facts, and the judge is going to tell them what the law means, and then they're going to interpret the facts and make a decision. The judge can be both the trier of fact and trier of law in a bench trial. They're going to be both. You're going to have, sometimes though, if you're going to have a jury, you're going to have jury selection, where you go in, you've probably heard the term, or you may have heard the term voir dire, where you ask questions, and some of these big trials, like I said, you hire jury consultants, you're like, I want to get rid of that juror is good for me, that juror is not good for me, there's all different reasons of why you want gender, race, ethnicity, their type of business that they do. I've been subpoenaed to go for jury duty 5 or 6 times. I've always been excused because who wants a lawyer on their jury? Like, I'm going to tell them what the case is about. I'm going to be sitting there with my 12 best buddies that we've been sitting in rooms for all the time. I'd be like, this is this, this is this, this is this. And they're like, well, Hans been practicing law for 35 years. We're going to follow him. You don't want lawyers on your jury panel. So I get excused, but a lot of people don't. But you go through the jury selection, you figure that out. Then you have opening statement, whether it's a bench or not, the opening statement. The lawyers get up and say, I represent Jones Company. And Jones Company is being sued for not paying Mr. Hanahan for the work they did. And you wave your arms and you tell a story. And you say in the opening statement, we will show you X, Y, and Z. Technically, you're not allowed to argue. You're not allowed to say, Mr. Hanahan is a really bad guy. Because that's not. They're going to say, we're going to show you facts of how Mr. Hanahan acted during the course of this case. But they can't argue. It's an opening statement. It's supposed to be factually based. Then you put on your witnesses. You present evidence. We've all seen that on TV shows and things like that. It's not like you see on TV most of the time. It's really boring. It's really static. But sometimes you get some. There are times when you get that little spark that happens. I've had a couple of times in my career where, like, I kind of as one of my very good friends, she's like, she was a consultant for me for this big, big case that I had for many years, and we went to federal trial, and I had this witness on the stand, and I was asking him questions, and I was asking, and I was like, kind of, I had planned out my questions. Like, I'm the one asking the questions, so I can lead them down, hopefully, the area that I want to go. And if they start answering over here, I'm going to be like, Your Honor, that's not my question. Can you instruct the witness to answer my question? They can't just start rambling and doing whatever they want. And I eventually got them to admit to A, B, C, which meant they had to admit to D. And when they got to C and they just finished it, the light bulb put on this guy's head. He knew the D question was coming. He's a smart guy, but didn't realize that A and B. And so when I asked D, he had to answer yes. And my colleague, she was like, I just saw you knitting that sweater and wrapping him up in it. That was what she told me. It was really kind of fun. That's happened like one or two times in my career. I've been doing this 35 years. So you don't get those Perry Mason type things in trial, but you do get to wave your hands and put on evidence. Closing arguments, that's when you get to argue. Mr. Hanahan with blah, blah, blah. You heard this person talk about how bad. You heard this. You heard that. That's when you get to do the passion, you know? Like, one of my favorite trial movies, which has absolutely nothing to do with the trial and how a trial is My Cousin Vinny. I don't know if you guys have ever seen My Cousin Vinny. But when he's up there and Joe Pesci is talking with, what's her name? She won the Oscar for it. Anyway, they're going through that. It's like, that's the drama of the closing argument. I mean, it's way, way overblown, but it's one of the most fun court scenes if you ever want to let My Cousin Vinny. So, after closing arguments, you have jury instructions if there's a jury. If there's a bench, there's a trial judge, Marissa Tomei. Yeah, that was the actress. If there's a bench judge, you don't necessarily have jury instructions, but the jury instructions help instruct the jury about the law. So you present them to the judge. The judge says, yes, this is the right application of the law. Both sides, so you give that to the jury, and then they come back and give a verdict or a judgment. So that's the process that happens in trial. The last thing that happens in a trial, but not in arbitration, as I said, is there's an appeal, if you want. Maybe you lost, and you shouldn't have to pay that money, or for whatever the injury is, whether it's a tort or a contract claim or otherwise, and you don't agree with what the jury came back in, or you think the judge committed error by letting evidence in that was improper, or what may have happened. You can file an appeal. Appeal are done, principally done on written briefs. And they are on very narrow issues that came up in the trial. It's not like they completely screwed everything up. You have to identify 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 issues where there was an error made at the trial level. And as a result of that error, it either needs to be retried or they lost the case. And the appeal court can make either one of those decisions depending on what the error is. Oral arguments are possible, but they are very rare. I've argued one oral argument in front of the Illinois Appellate Court in my career. I don't do a lot of appellate court work. I was very surprised that I was able to do it. It was like kind of really cool moment and everything else. But most people, I would say less than 5% in the state of Illinois go to oral argument. And if it's in Cook County, it's definitely less than, or the first district, which is where Cook County is, it's definitely less than 1% of all appeals are orally argued. It's mostly done on briefs, on written papers. Question?
Is there a specific reason why that it's written versus oral?
I think there's a number of them. One is there are so many things that come in that there's only a limited number of judges that are on the appellate court system. And so they don't have as many judges to hear all the arguments. The other thing is that is probably most of the biggest reason is that there's other cases that are out there that will guide the judges. And so they will read the facts, but they don't want lawyers coming up and just then waving their hands and trying to do that. So they're going to take an oral argument where it's a novel issue. So the one where I wrote, where I got to argue it orally, and it was on insurance coverage, but it had to do with a construction case. But I got to argue this. There had never been a case like that ever in the state of Illinois. So this was going to be new law. It was a branch of something that had very strong foundation. So I argued with the foundation of the law, but it was this tiny little branch that came out, and now it's the law of the land because of the way we argued. So that's why they took it as an oral argument. So novel, or it's tiny and stuff. And that's why, like, it's less than 1% in Cook County because it's such a big jurisdiction. Whereas if you're downstate, you're going to have the judges and less lawsuits, so they may hurry up because they have more time. So any other questions on that? Okay, next one we're going to talk about, like I said, there was three. We talked about litigation, so that's courts, arbitration, and then we'll do mediation. Arbitration. For arbitration, you file a demand for arbitration. It's just a nomenclature. It's like a complaint, but it's just called a demand. It's the same type of thing. The difference is, it's not nearly as formal as a complaint in the law. Like, you don't have to go through paragraph by paragraph and laying things out. A demand for arbitration could be, I was hired by Jones Company to design them this building. They were supposed to pay me $10,000. They paid me $8,000. I didn't get paid. I did my work. I am demanding an arbitration from them. It can be as informal as that. There are no requirements. That would be a paragraph. Whereas if it was a complaint, it might be 5 pages because it has to say the statutes and the contract and attached and everything else. Now, that's not to say that it's recommended to just put a couple sentences in, because if you can put teeth behind your argument, then you're already ahead of the game. But you do not have to in arbitration. Just has to be in writing demanding that there's an arbitration. There's an answering statement, which is like an answer to a complaint, and they can make a counter demand. And the answering statement, again, can be a narrative, it can be writing. They could maybe have gotten this long complaint, a lot of questions, blah, 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 blah. And then they write a paragraph back and said, I read their complaint, it's all hogwash, I didn't do any of this. Not only did they not grind out all their money, he owed me money. That could be an answering statement. That's all that's necessary for arbitration to kind of get the ball rolling. Again, it's not recommended, but you have no requirements on either the demand or the answering statement. There's going to be then an arbitrator selection process. If you're going to file a case in the court systems, the court has this docket system where things roll through and they just automatically assign you a judge. You don't have a choice over the judges. Now, you may get a judge that there's a bias and you can ask for a recusal in a new judge, but that's very rare. So in litigation, the system gives you the judge and that's the person you work with. In arbitration, what normally happens is, you remember I talked about in arbitration you had to have that written agreement in the beginning? Normally that paragraph's not going to just say, we agree to do this to resolve disputes by arbitration. It's going to say, and we're going to use the rules of the American Arbitration Association, or we're going to use the rules of whatever governing body that you want to use. And for cases of X dollars, it's going to be one arbitrator. For cases of over X dollars, it'll be 3 arbitrators. And there's going to be some processes spelled out about how you pick the people that are going to be your arbitrators, the people that are going to make the decisions about your case. Some are very formal, like if you go through the American Arbitration Association, the AAA, they have a process where they give you a list of names and then you do blind matching. And I say, I like these 3 people, I hate these 3 people, and I don't care either way about these 3 people, and you send it in, and the other side does the same thing. And if any of them match, then they become part of your panel. Sometimes it takes a long time. I had a case where we went through 4 rounds of 20 arbitrators in each packet. So 80 arbitrators they were given to us between me and the contractor and a number of subcontractors. At the end of the day, of all 80, we agreed on one party, one individual. We rejected, there was never matches for anybody else, so all parties have to match. And so the American Arbitration Association said, fine, we're not going to give you any more choices. Here's 2 other people. They're your panel. Done. And we were stuck with them. And one of them was really bad. That just happens. And you're stuck with it. But they're the people that are going to be deciding your case. So, like I said, by agreement contract, the rules are defined. Panel members depends on the size of the dispute. A lot of times, like in the American Arbitration Association, I think $1 million is the cutoff. If the dispute is less than $1 million, there's 1 panel member. If it's more than $1 million, it's 3, or that's a common thing. Again, I'm not sure. I don't remember specifically what the AAA says, but a lot of times that's a cutoff in a contract. You're right, million, over million, 3, under million, 1 panel member. So you get your panel, and those are the people that are going to be your judge and your jury. Now, what's supposed to happen in arbitration, and this is why people in the construction industry, why it became such a big deal, arbitration kind of came into vogue in the construction industry as the better choice than going to court in the 70s. And by the 80s, everybody was going to arbitration. By the 90s, people realized maybe we shouldn't all go to arbitration. And now, starting in the 2007, and I'll talk about the AAA documents later on, now you get to make your choice. There's no, like the previous AAA contracts, it was mediation, arbitration was in there, and if you wanted to go to litigation, you had to strike a paragraph. Now you get to choose between arbitration and litigation. So the The concept of arbitration was always supposed to be better, faster, shorter. It's better because the panel members are normally people that have your subject matter interests. So if I'm going to be in a construction lawsuit, my panel members are probably going to be either contractors, architects, or construction lawyers. They know the language. They know the lingo. They're not judges, and they're not the average just person walking on the street. If I'm in the court system, I may have a judge that never had a construction case, so you never really know. So it's supposed to be better because you have people that know the issues. It's supposed to be faster because we have a limited discovery, and it's supposed to be cheaper because we have a limited discovery. If you remember when we were in court, that last sentence says discovery is the longest and most expensive part of litigation. And so there's limitations on discovery and arbitration, or there used to be. Lawyers, we like to have documents and papers and make sure we never make a mistake and everything else. So arbitration now is a lot like litigation. Like, I have a big arbitration that I've been working on, like I said, for 8 years. It's probably 400,000 documents. It's just as big as if we'd gone to court. And there'll be no right of appeal. So there's been some things that have gone one way or the other and then can't do anything about it. So there's problems with it. But the theory behind it is there's a mutual document exchange. I don't have to write those papers. Remember you said, like, I have to write papers. I was telling you in that thing. I want you to give me A, B, C, D, E, and F, and I write those things down. In arbitration, I don't have to send you that paper. You just send me A, B, C, D, and F. Well, you may send me A, B, and C, and I'm not sure, and then we have to go back and forth. So sometimes what you end up doing is you do that written discovery request so you cover your bases. But normally it's this agreed-upon mutual exchange, so you don't have to do the rigmarole of filing a motion to compel, another motion to compel, a motion for sanctions, and another sanctions. But that sometimes happens in arbitration now because people play games, lawyers play games. And by the way, I will disparage my profession a lot during the course of this class. I love my profession. There's great people in it, but there's problems with our system. It's just like anything else. Interrogatories are not limited or not used or very limited, but if you have a big case, then you ask the panel, can we submit these written questions? Depositions are also usually limited. You can only have so many depositions. You can't take everybody and their brother and sister. And if we issue these third-party subpoenas, we're going to limit it to these people. Or we're going to limit it to how many hours you're supposed to do. Or always trying to keep the cost and the time down. That's traditional in arbitration. I've had that in many arbitration cases where you get 3 hours, that's it, done. And you can't ask any more questions. And that's it. And you may, in a court case, you may ask that person questions for 3 days, but in arbitration, you get 3 hours. That's just the way it goes. The decisions, unless it's otherwise set in the contract, the decisions about how much discovery, it's the arbitrator that makes the decision. So sometimes you can lay out your discovery process in your contract, but if it's silent, like most of them are, the panel's like, we don't think you need to take any depositions. You can't take any. Exchange your documents, and then we'll go to hearing. Sometimes that happens. So they are the ultimate decision makers on what rules we can play, what the rules of the monopoly are. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good. They have some control over discovery produced, and then subpoenas, as I said. You can get to those third parties, but they have to be the arbitrators to say, why are we going to Tammy Smith over here? Why is she required to be appearing for this case or submitting documents? And you have to tell the panel why, and then they can make a decision. But we don't agree. They don't need to come in. Sometimes even, like, I've been on cases where there's an expert. The expert is testifying at the hearing, and they are basing their position of their expert testimony on things that would happen in the course of the case because they've read all these documents, and they've analyzed it, and they've come to a conclusion. And then I've asked that expert, what documents do you have to support that? Oh, they're in my project file. Have you produced those documents? No, I have not. Panel, can we get an order, have them produce the documents? No, you may not. So the expert can be making up some decision, and there can be no backup and no backup documents or anything else. And if the panel doesn't want to force the expert to produce them, they can say no, and then you move on. So there's pluses and minuses. Again, it reduces the paper, reduces the time, narrows the issues. That's for better, faster, cheaper. But it also can limit what information you have by the people that you want to ask those questions. Pros and cons. Questions on that so far? Evidentiary hearing. So instead of a trial, we have a hearing. Same thing. You still have opening statements. You get to wave your arms around. You present witnesses, but they may be limited. Evidence is handled much differently in in a court versus an arbitration. Arbitration is kind of the Wild West. In court, you have very strict rules about what type of evidence can come on. You've probably heard of the term hearsay. There's all these rules about that in court. In arbitration, they're like, oh, we can get that. We figure that out. We've done this. We understand. So a lot more documents and a lot more extraneous information come in arbitration as opposed to the controls of the trial. And in fact, in trial, if you break some of the evidentiary rules, that can be a ground of appeal. Arbitration, Wild West. Doesn't matter. You do closing arguments. Sometimes, I've had many arbitrations where the judges, the panel members are like, we've been listening to you talk for weeks. We don't need to hear you anymore. Just write it down in a brief, and we'll read the briefs and we'll make our ruling. So that sometimes happens. You don't get to do that closing argument. You don't get to say why Mike Hannigan was such a bad guy. The award may be in writing, but it also may be what's called a reasoned decision. The writing may be, say, Jones Company, you owe Mike Hannigan $2,000. So say we all. That could be the award in just one thing without any description of why they decided that. You can ask the panel for a reasoned decision, then they'll write their reasons and kind of how they interpret things. But it's not always the same. So it's a little different in the way the court system works. Again, no right of appeal. That's really important. When you make that decision, is this a bet your company type issue? Is this something that's personally related? Do you want to be at the situation where you had a bad outcome and you're stuck with that? That's a reason why maybe not to do arbitration. Another reason why to do arbitration is, do you want your dirty laundry aired in public? Because if we go into court, they're all public documents and everybody can see it. Arbitration is behind a veil of secrecy. As long as you've agreed to that with the parties, then it's confidential. Sometimes they're not confidential. That's very rare. But you can have arbitrations confidential. So there's pluses and minuses of why you want to do one over the other. But the big minus is there's no right of appeal. You cannot go back and say, this panel screwed up. The law says A. They said Q. They aren't even close to A. And the panels, if you take that to court, the court's basically going to say, you guys agreed to arbitration, that's the way it goes. There are some limited exceptions of an appeal. If you can show a bias, if you can show, oh, one of the panel members represented my client in another case. That's a bias, because they were his lawyer somewhere else, and we didn't know about that. Or, one of the panel members is married to the sister of the owner of the company. That's a bias. You can get the panel award overturned by that. But then you have to go through the whole process again. So again, there's costs and things involved. But generally, you can't have lack of jurisdiction, make an error of laws. Those are not things that you can overturn by appeal. Questions on that? Yes?
So is the lack of jurisdiction, I mean, what is the
lack of... Oh, good question. Lack of jurisdictions means sometimes... let me think about this. How would be the best way to describe it? Jurisdiction can be based on it's a location thing and the applicability of the law. But sometimes, let's say that your arbitration agreement talked about the fact, that's why it's very rare, talked about the fact that we need subject matter experts to be our panel, and they need to be licensed to do X, Y, and Z. Maybe they're licensed architects or licensed lawyers in the state of California. Because what you're designing may ultimately have to do with, you know, a earthquake issue. And then you go through, you can't get the panel members because people aren't agreeing, and then the AAA comes and appoints somebody that works out of Wyoming. Well, they don't have the jurisdictional requirements that are required by the location of where that case is being interpreted and the law being applied. That may be a question that comes in the case. Very rare that it happens. I've had a number of arbitrations where the arbitrators are not from the same state. Like, you have a case in Illinois, the arbitrators are from Michigan, but they generally, the law doesn't have any nuanced differences, so you just go with them because they're construction lawyers or whatever. So, question?
Yeah, so from the kind of arbitrator's perspective, it sounds like it's somewhat like being licensed for jury.
Yes. It is like being jury duty because they are the trier of fact. They also, and depending on what type of arbitrator you get, they are the judge too. And so they, my way or the highway. Sometimes you have arbitrators that think that they are God and they make decisions on their own that they have no basis in. I've been in arbitrations where the panel has said, you must do this, even though the other side isn't asking you to do this. They just decided on their own. And because they feel that they need more information. I have very common in arbitration. I'll be in the middle of asking questions of a witness, and the arbitrator will interrupt and say, Mr. Hannigan, I need to ask them some questions. And they will become the examiner. And they can ask whatever questions you want. And that sometimes happens in a bench trial too, but less common. But I have been in arbitrations where I've had a series of questions, and how it's presented, as far as I'm concerned, is as important as the final answer. And the panel will come in and just go straight to the final answer and not hear any of the nuances of how bad the other person is or the games that they were playing or anything else like that. And you get to the answer, and then when they turn the questioning back to you, you start the process like, hey, we already went through this. Move on. And you're like, well, but I want it. Move on. And they will just say, move on, and you can't do anything. And there's a chunk of your case that never gets heard. And there's relevant, important stuff that never happens. So, yes, they are a jury, kind of listening to it and making decision and doing the balancing of the scales, but they also become the judge, and they can be a pain. They can be good, too. I mean, I've had other arbitrators who are like, yeah, let's hear that. Let's hear what that has to say. You know, it just depends on the personalities. And because there's no appeal, there's no checks and balances on them. It's good and bad. Like, I am not a proponent of arbitration. I will do arbitration, and then maybe that is leaked through in hearing me talking about this a little bit. I will do arbitration for clients that want to do that because they want to. They're in a high profile. They want to things private. They want to do, or because they've had their experience with litigation. I've had people that said I've been to court and I just did not like it, so let's try arbitration, and I will do that with them, and I'll put that into their contract. But the majority of the people that I represent, I always require mediation because it's always good to try to talk it out before you spend tons of dollars. And if you can get a third party neutral, because we're going to talk about that in a second, mediation, it's just get somebody that's not invested in it. You don't have to listen to your lawyer tell the story, or their lawyer tell the story. It's a third party. I will always do mediation, and then I will skip to litigation because I like the guardrails. I like the predictability. I can keep the cost the same as arbitration. In fact, I probably can keep it less because sometimes arbitration can be the Wild West. So, but there are some people that love arbitration. So it's not a bad option. It's just not something that I think is favorable for my practice of what I do. So, okay, as I was saying, the next thing is mediation. This is the non-binding part of the dispute resolution. So it's a business resolution. It's the parties to say, let's drop the gloves. We're still angry at each other. We still hate you from the last movie. But let's try to work this out because it's better paying each other or figuring this out than paying people like Hannigan because he is way too expensive. He's going to be around there to guide us through, and he's going to have the process to move us along, or we're going to have our lawyer move us along. But let's not pay the exorbitant fees, and let's not go through all the giant discovery process. But we're not quite sure if we think this person is always going to be able to get the answer right, so let's make it non-binding. They're going to be this neutral, this third-party neutral. They're going to tell us what they believe, and they're going to be really smart, and they're going to have gone to court, and they're going to know judges, they're going to know the law, they're going to be really good people when they do this, and we're going to trust them, and hopefully this individual could help us bridge the gap between the two. So it's non-binding. Second bullet here, sometimes they combine it with an arbitration. Sometimes you have a one single panel arbitrator, and during the course of the arbitration, he may separate himself out and do a mediator, or she may say, we're going to do mediation first, and then I'll be your arbitrator, or we're going to do arbitration, and then if we can't get it right before I give you my judgment, we're going to have a mediation and kind of see where that goes. So that can happen where they combine the two, but it's rare. But it's arb-meet or meet-arb is what they call it, but it does happen. Two types of mediation. There's what's called evaluative, that's number one, and the second is facilitative. Evaluative comes into the facilitative somewhat, but the evaluative is they really get into the merits of the case. They read the briefs. They listen to the arguments. They see the depositions. They look at the strengths and weaknesses of the case. They are evaluating your right of recovery and what will happen if it went to court. They're going to look at it as, if I'm a judge, the evaluative mediator is going to act more like a judge in applying the law. And then at the end, after they've heard the stories, in a mediation will normally be a day or two at the most. The parties come in, they'll have it at the offices of the mediator, and it'll be one mediator, not three, it always is normally one mediator. And you're at the office of the mediator, and let's say there's four parties. Each party will have their own conference room, so they don't ever talk, but they talk to themselves. And then you have an opening portion where everybody's in the room together and everybody talks, and then you split up, and the mediator goes from room to room to room. And so sometimes what ends up happening is in the evaluative mediation, that mediator's going to tell you, both during the mediation and afterwards when they write their reasoned analysis, they're going to tell you what they think would happen if it went to court. And so here's where the dollar should come in, and it's going to be a very intense reasoned decision. Now, it's more expensive to have an evaluative mediator, and you have to have good ones to be evaluative mediators. Not to say that facilitative mediators are bad, and all evaluative mediators use facilitative actions, but you're really going to dig into the guts with the evaluative mediator. That will cost more money. So you're going to be spending more money on some early discovery, and you're going to be spending more money on writing it up to give the mediator the guts. So it's a little more expensive. Facilitative doesn't evaluate the deep dig claim in great detail through legal. They're not going to go and look at the case law. They're not going to be as much of the judge. They're going to be more the jury. But they still will wear a judge's hat. But again, both cases are non-binding, so it's never really their decision anyway. What they're going to do is much more of the shell of diplomacy. So those are often you're going to see facilitated mediation in a smaller case, you know, worth not millions and millions of dollars, because they're going to say, I know you have $200,000 damages on your house, but do you really want to pay Hanahan $350,000 to litigate this? Let's talk about the money. What if I got you $100,000? I know it's not all $200,000, but instead of you spending lawyers, you get to go home, you hire a contractor. Maybe you can get a contractor for less than $200,000 quote you got. So what's your best thing? And they go back and forth and they talk about practicalities and if they're facilitative. Now they will bring in the merits of the case. They will talk about stuff. It's not like they don't evaluate the claims. But there's going to be much more shuttle diplomacy of trying to get things done. Many more mediators are like that. And a lot of times what I find, and this is just my practice, if I prepare for a facilitative mediation like I'm going to arbitration or trial, maybe not all the discovery, but if I have all of the information, as much of the information as I can, and not spend a ton of money for my client because I'm not taking depositions, I'm not stretching it out over years, but if I spend the time digging in and learning the facts, when that facilitative mediator comes to me, I will know more about the case than he will or she will. And I will explain my case more to him or her. And so when they go to the next room and the next room and the next room, they're taking my knowledge with them because I am much more knowledgeable about it than they are because they're not supposed to necessarily go. So if you go to a facilitative mediation, if ever you guys are in a mediation and you're talking to your lawyer about it, and they say it's a facilitative mediation, ask them, how much have you prepared for it? I prepare for it like it's a trial, it's a big deal. So I get a leg up and I can help push the mediator in my direction. I had one case where a mediator, I'll get you in a second, where I had a mediator, he's a good friend of mine, really good mediator, but it was a long day. We were on the other side. They were asking for like $5 or $6 million from us, and we were ready to pay without blinking $1 million. We knew we could probably get hit if we went to trial up to $3 million, but there was no way they were going to get $6 million or whatever they were asking for. And but we were far enough apart, you know, 6-1. I guess a big gap. Even if they were 4, I don't know where they were at. And the mediator was facilitative, and we were shuttling back and forth. But he evaluated the claim, but he was more facilitative. Great guy. And he was like looking at his watch. It's like 4:30, and I'm like, he's waiting to check out. He's waiting for 5:00 to like blow the whistle and going home. And so I pulled him aside because I'd been talking to the lawyer earlier on in the lunch break for the other side, and apparently it was a company up in Wisconsin, and they had flown down in their private plane. And so they didn't have to catch a plane. So there's a lot of excuses. The other side's like, oh, we got to go. We got to catch a plane. They didn't have to catch a plane. In fact, they made a big deal out of it. So I put the mediator aside. I'm like, hey, look, these guys have their own plane. They can leave whenever they want. We're not going home at 5:00. We're going to push through this. And I know if we don't feed them, swear to God, I said this to them, and this is a tactic that many mediators use anyway. If we don't feed them and their blood sugars start to drop, we're going to get them. We settled the case for $1.2 million. Took about 3 hours, but we got it done. Was it because they really wanted to get home? Was it because the case was more expensive? Was it because I talked to the mediator and everything else? I don't know. But my client was really happy because he knew that they could get hit for $3 million. They were asking for $6 million. They wrote a check for $1.2 million that day. We're done. And they got on the plane, and they flew back, and we had dinner in the restaurant downstairs. It was fun. So it was a good evening. But, you know, you never know. But that's what can happen to facilitated mediation. Again, neither is better or worse than the other. It's just a different way you think about mediation. You had a question.
So kind of two questions, but I think they're both related. So the first question is, since this is non-binding, like, is there, so for example, with the example you just gave, and your client wrote a check for $1.2 million, it's non-binding, but can the client who, or the person who received the $1.2 million go back and say, well, I don't feel like they gave me enough to, like, you know, handle my grievances or my injuries, and so I still want to take it to court. Is that a possibility because it's non-binding?
Great question. So the answer is no. Because every good mediator will have on their laptop a settlement agreement, which is a contract. And so once the parties agree in principle, they'll say, I'll be back in 20 minutes, and they'll type in the names, and they'll type in the facts and everything else, and they'll say, the parties have agreed to this, and this is, normally it's what's called a MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, it's not the full settlement agreement, and it'll say the parties to agree to have a full and complete executed settlement within 2 weeks of this, but the parties agree to these specific facts, and it'll say, release of the claim, settlement agreement, and $1.2 million, and both parties sign it, and that, even if we never get to the full detailed settlement agreement, that MOU, you can bring to court, and then they can't renege on paying that $1.2 million or say I wanted more. So it's just that, so that won't happen. If you have a mediation and the mediator doesn't have one of those MOUs or settlement agreements on their laptop, then you pull out your laptop and you bring one up. So you don't walk out of that room without a signature from both sides. So I guess theoretically it could happen, but don't let it happen. Like, make sure everybody signs on the dotted line for that.
But you're saying, like, that's still not, like, an actual contract.
It is a contract.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. It's just not as detailed as all the facts of, like, will it be paid over a period of 6 months? Will it be paid right away? You know, there's going to be specific things that come into it that are the legalese that the lawyers want to put in. But a good MOU is going to be a couple, 3 pages long, and it's probably normally put together by a lawyer or a pre-settlement agreement. And so even if that's all you have, it's binding enough to get the dollars. That's where the basis of it is. And then the judge will be like, guys, I have this. It's signed by both the parties. Your lawyers are need to get their heads together, and the judge will yell at the lawyer, because then you bring it to a judge. I have this contract. And you bring it to the judge, and the judge will yell at the lawyers and say, get your act together and get this done, because I'm going to enforce this agreement. So, okay. Last slide. Mediation process. So I think we talked about this. Individual meetings, they're going to have, so you have this, mediators come together, you are put in separate rooms, but individually you're going to write written submissions. So you're going to at least, whether it's facilitative or evaluative, you still got to give the mediator your story. And your story's going to have the facts, and if you're writing a good paper, it's going to have the law of why you should win. So here's the, you know, it's going to say, here's our claim, here's our duty, here's the breach of duty, here's the injury, here's the causation, here's the damages, here's the law that supports it. So you're going to put that in your written papers. And you're going to submit it. Sometimes they're exchanged between the parties so they can see it. Sometimes they go to the mediator and it's secret. That becomes a decision and a discussion that happens between the parties and the mediators. Sometimes the mediators say, I demand it to be secret. Sometimes the mediators say, I demand, if you want me to mediate, then we exchange. Those are processes that happen in the course of the mediation. Then you have joint sessions between the parties. That's where everybody gets to that same morning. You've had your coffee and donuts, and you come into a room, and you do a mini kind of like opening statement. But maybe you only get 15 minutes, and the party's like, I've had mediations where we've had a long conference table, and one party's way down on that end, and this party's way up on this end. And there is not, because they hate each other so much. I've had parties where they're talking, and they do most of the talking. It is my practice in a mediation to be as quiet as possible and let the parties talk. Because mediation is a cathartic business resolution. If I'm trying to tell the story and being a lawyer, my party has lost. Because they don't get the ability to say, I aired my grievance. It is so helpful for settling a case if you can just get your dirty laundry out and say, and sometimes it gets heated, but it helps them later when you want to convince them to settle the case. But that happens, and sometimes, like I said, it can be confrontational, but you have your day in court. I have been in many mediations where the other side gets up there, the lawyer reads the outline, they have their slideshow, their PowerPoint, whatever it is, and then it falls flat because their clients are sitting there kind of like toadstools, and they don't feel like they're a part of it. Whereas I ask questions of my clients. I'm just like, Tammy, tell me about this. What happened here? I will have already gone over them the outline. I've told them what the story's going to be. I've written the script for them. But I tell them, I want you to tell the story. And they talk about it. And then it gets part of the process. And the mediator will listen to the people just psychologically more than they'll listen to the talking head lawyer. So, anyway, mediations can be interrupted or continued. I've had mediations where you go a few days and then you break for a week or two, maybe a month because of everybody's schedules, because it's trying to work out a business resolution. Or I've had a mediation, you've gone 2 days, we have not resolved it, but we don't think we're done. We think we can maybe get it done. And the mediator says, do you guys mind if I continue to talk to you back and forth? And then there'll be a series of phone calls where the mediator will call you, the mediator will call the other side, and he or she will continue to try to get closer and closer. And I've had many mediations that settle after those 2 days or 1 day. You can still get the deal done, and then it saves literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. Hopefully it gets a resolution. Settlement, like I said, may occur during the mediation or a later date. And then they're going to have this binding agreement, which goes to your question down here, that can later be enforced. So the mediators will do that. If what normally happens, if it settles later, you're going to have that full-blown settlement agreement with all the bells and whistles. If it's at the night of the mediation, it's going to be this shrunken-down document. That's it. Sorry, I had too much chatting in the beginning today, so we did go the full time today. I will promise that it will be shorter next week. But any questions on this? Okay. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend. I will see you next Friday. And I know the three people that are not here, so I'll send them out the lecture so they have that. So, thanks, guys.